I'd like to call it to order today's meeting, the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance. Today, April 11, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Cornish?
Here.
Ellison?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Meslow?
Here.
Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Sodstrom?
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, so we have two sets of minutes. Let's begin the day on a bipartisan note. Do we have a motion on the first set of minutes from April 4? Representative Johnson moves approval. Any discussion on the April 4 minutes? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, the minutes are adopted. May I have a motion on the minutes from April 6? Representative Hillstrom moves approval. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, those minutes are adopted. Members, just want to go through a few notes that I have in front of me to describe what I hope we can do today, and then we'll get on with it. We're going to be finalizing the work that we began March 2nd, and in a moment I'm going to move House File 2953, and excuse me, and then I'll be offering the DE1 amendment, which will be incorporating about 50 of the bills that we've worked on together since the beginning of committee. A key part of what the DE1 amendment is and what I hope will become a product of this committee is a two-anchor approach on vital issues of public safety facing Minnesota. One of the anchors is Representative Ellison's bias crime bill, which was spurred by a cross burning at a church in St. Paul. It would require a jury to find that a crime was motivated by group-based hatred and then would increase the already existing extra penalties for such crimes. The other anchor is the law enforcement inquiry provision. This has been called the sanctuary law, but has been properly noted that the local ordinances, or pointed out rather, that local ordinances it would repeal are not really sanctuary laws. By linking these initiatives against domestic hatred and foreign-born violence, I hope that we can put together a product and bring together, in very blunt English, the left and the right in a stand against two kinds of evil. If we cannot pass both, then I'm going to ask the committee to set aside both. We'll have about 47 amendments before us today, and if you look at your playbill or your suggested legal size listing, I've separated those into four categories, hopefully in order to achieve some kind of orderly moving through these amendments. Members, the House leadership has asked me to see whether we can include the collaborative efforts on from the immigration policy bill, House File 3306, rather than moving that separately. So the first six amendments reflect my understanding of what we agreed to on March 29th. So we're going to start with those in a moment. We have one omission, and that is the six-month task force to study overall immigration policies. No one's come forward with any further suggestions, so I will leave that for an author's amendment in Ways and Means, and we can perhaps hear ideas prior to that time. The next 24 amendments under subparagraph B on that sheet, I hope, will not take much testimony or time to go through. The amendments under item subparagraph C are amendments that I think will probably require some testimony, so I've lumped those together as well. Finally, there's a group of amendments related to the two-anchor approach that I've suggested, and those would be under the closing amendments. If we can advance this bill with both the bias crimes proposal and the law enforcement inquiry provision, I think that we have a chance to bridge some important gaps. If we can't conclude our work this morning, And we will be breaking for session at about 20 to 12 to give everyone a chance to get to the floor. Then we're going to return to this, excuse me, this room, the basement, at 4:30 this afternoon and work until we're done. One last note, and that is the leadership has asked me that we refer this bill to the Committee on Taxes because of the Fire Safety Fund issue. I'd hope that we could avoid that by a standalone bill, but we haven't been granted a hearing on that in the Tax Committee, so we'll just take that in stride and go from there. I don't anticipate, well, strike that. I hope we don't have any further meetings such as next Wednesday, but I've anticipated that possibility, so we have some room. We have a room scheduled if we need to wrap anything up next Wednesday. So with that, the chair will move House File 2953 to get it before the committee. And so that bill is before us on a motion that would be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Chair then would move the DE1 amendment to get that before us. And I think we'll go right into the next item, which would be item 1 on this list. I'm going to refer to that for the time being. That would be Representative Soderstrom. Would you tell us what amendment you have first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A26 amendment to House File 2953 is Representative Tingelsted's human trafficking bill, which was heard in this committee and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. It adds an appropriation of $75,000 to the Commissioner of Public Safety to develop a statewide plan to address human trafficking, and it also requires that the plan would include, number one, training for law enforcement, prosecution, social services, and others. It would this amendment says that there would be public awareness on human trafficking and procedures for working with non-governmental agencies to prevent human trafficking. And this amendment requires the commissioner to report the plan to the legislature by December 15th of 2006. And also allows the members of the task force to receive reimbursement for their expenses. And Representative Tingelsted and Diane Cushman are here if you have any questions about this A26 amendment.
On the motion to adopt the A26 amendment to the D1 amendment, Representative Tingelsted, or...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate your time and consideration, and just stand for questions.
Questions. Representative Tingle said, do you know, does this language of A26 amendment reflect the Senate language?
Could we get our members, yes, the judge.
All right. Any further questions on this amendment? On the A26 amendment, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The A26 is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Chair will move the A36 amendment, which is the fraudulent ID provisions or the fraudulent identity documents, which I believe incorporates and includes Representative Hillstrom's language. Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct, that it does incorporate it.
Okay. Any other questions on the A36 for adoption? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. A36 is adopted. Chair also moves the A37. This is the one on the computer crimes that we did here and was passed out of committee. Any questions on the A37? If not, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and that one's adopted. on the 840. Chair also moves that one. That contains the language on the employer sanctions knowingly and cooperation, I believe. Any questions on the A40, excuse me.
Chair,
Representative Paymer.
Was this the portion that Representative Hamilton amended?
Representative Paymer, it includes the Hamilton waiver that was presented, but not the task force for cooperation with the federal government waiver.
I'm just trying to recall what he, what the existing language was before. Linus, were there penalties that were imposed upon employers who hired undocumented illegal immigrants?
Could we get Mr. Diebel will help us out.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Hamilton inserted an exception in Subdivision 4, which precluded those employers who were complying with or cooperating with federal immigration authorities to screen their applicants. The language still permits fines against certain employers who hire illegal immigrants, but those that are cooperating with federal authorities are exempt from the fines.
And, Mr. Chair, in cooperation means what? That they... How would you define cooperation?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, the program that Representative Hamilton informed the committee about was one where the immigration authorities actually work directly with the employer, where they send applicants through some sort of screening system, and he identified that as a grounds for a good faith effort to avoid hiring illegal immigrants, and that those employers should not be subjected to fines.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the 840? If there are not, then those in favor of the 840 adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. It is adopted. Chair would move the 827 amendment. This contains, members, this contains the language where we defined and or focused the work of the Special Crimes Unit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious as to if it wouldn't make more sense on line 1.6 to actually remove the illegal immigrant and so it focuses on crimes involving the illegal immigrant community and felony-level crimes that target immigrant communities. Therefore, it could be illegal or legal immigrant community if it's felony crimes against them.
That's a good point.
Representative Hillstrom, restate how you would alter the wording.
Line 1.6, delete the word illegal.
Okay. Any questions? I would accept that as a friendly amendment. Any questions on the 827? If not, those in favor of the 827, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. And that one's adopted. Chair also moves the 848 amendments. This further addresses the Special Crimes Unit. And pursuant to the testimony we heard, we've incorporated language focusing on their initial assignments. Any questions? On the Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has there been any change since we've seen this in the last... okay.
Representative Hillstrom, no, I don't believe so.
Okay.
There's no questions on the 848. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
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 Motion prevails. 848 is adopted. Representative Murphy, looking at the listing on the legal size sheet of paper that we have in our packets, items 7, 8, and 9, would you be willing to move those as a block or move those at all?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, please.
I move adoption of 813, 812, and 828.
Representative Murphy, and I believe you would approve or already have perhaps that these would be one-time appropriations.
That's correct.
Okay. On the adoption of the A13, the A12, and the A28 amendments, are there any questions or discussion? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Those three are adopted. Representative Murphy, if I could direct your attention to item 10 and 11, which is the A19 or the A17, do you choose to move one or the other? Representative Murphy moves for adoption of the A19 amendments. Tell us what that does. Is that
this would give the Bureau of Criminal Apprehensions $31,000 to conduct background checks for the statewide mentoring program.
Very good. The A19 is before us. Any further questions on the A19? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the A19 is adopted. Representative Murphy, should we face a choice between the A43 or the A38? Would you care to handle that?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of A43. But the language should be for the effect that the $21,000 is for the study, for the scale back study, I believe.
Okay. Yes, that is correct.
A38 is without the money, but I would rather have the money.
A43 then, and it has the money in it, yes, ma'am, and it has the reference to the study on 110. On the A43 adoption, any discussion? One time allocation?
That's right.
All right, one time. Any questions from the committee? On the A43 adoption, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The A43 is adopted. Representative Johnson, A06.
Mr. Chairman, this amendment provides that a pattern sex offender who doesn't comply with treatment while incarcerated is considered non-compliant and subject to disciplinary proceedings. But my understanding is that Mr. Littman has agreed to provide a letter to the county attorney clarifying this issue. So, based on that, I think
A06 is withdrawn. Any questions on that? If not, let's move on to the A34, Representative Murphy.
Pardon me.
Do you choose to move the A34 amendment?
You know, that's Representative
It's my error. I ask your forgiveness. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. I believe that this is the amendment that goes back to, you had the bill about cell phones and crimes against teens, and this goes back, and removes the misdemeanor crimes for anyone who's previously been convicted, and would take it down to a petty misdemeanor, which was the intent in the beginning.
And just to restate and further clarify, we are not by this creating a petty mis. We are not creating a crime, if you will, for the act of the cell phone user. It was done last session. What we're doing is putting it to at the level that it was the intent of the body, and that's a petty misdemeanor, not a misdemeanor.
Correct.
Any questions on the 834 adoption? Hearing none, those in favor of the 834, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. 834 is adopted. Representative Nelson, 835.
This is a slight technical amendment that was brought to me by the telephone company. If they want, on page 101, line 11, is to insert after invoice in writing. That starts a 90-day period. They wanted so that there was no question as to whether when that 90-day period started for the appeal of the charge. So that's just basically just adding words in writing so that they don't call them up and complain about something and say that was your notice that we're complaining about this. They want it in writing.
Very good. Any questions on that amendment? Any questions? If not, on the adoption of the 835, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The 835 is adopted. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of 815, which would delete bongs and water pipes from the drug paraphernalia section, based on the reaction that I had when we heard testimony on the bill. But bongs and water pipes are cultural instruments that are used in a variety of cultures, and I don't think that they should be perceived as drug paraphernalia.
Very good. Any questions on that amendment? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, I'm trying to find that portion of the bill, but when I read the very end, it looked like bongs were still involved or not deleted. What page of the public safety bill does your amendment address? I think I can find it that way.
Page 32, line 20.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Newman.
If you go to page 33, line 3, would not the word a bong also have to be deleted at that point? Just a question on my part.
Staff, does this amendment cover that question or not? Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, that would be an appropriate amendment to make the subdivision to comply with the changes Representative Murphy is.
Representative Murphy, do you accept that? Is it friendly?
I do, Chair. Thank you, Representative Newman.
Staff, please make the notation. Then further discussion on the amendment as amended. On 815, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. 815 is adopted. Representative Hillstrom, do you have the AO5?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The AO5 amendment was actually brought to me by the department. In the last bill, House File 1, we required sex offenders to have their pictures taken every 6 months in order to track the changes. However, the department doesn't believe, nor do I believe, that we ought to be photographing those who are still incarcerated and are not getting out. So it has been an undue burden on the department, and I would make the rules clarify, saying that they do not have to take these photographs when they're in prison or in county jail if they're not getting out.
Any questions on that amendment? Any discussion? If not, on the AO5 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The AO5 is adopted. Representative Murphy, did you have the A3 last year? Do you want it this year?
I had it last year, Mr. Chairman, and I told Representative Abney that he's carrying it this year because of all the people that contacted me last year, and I still don't know anything about him.
We just thought we'd see if he wanted to do it. All right, we'll put that one aside. Thank you. Representative, what do we have next? Does anybody want to offer the flame-resistant tent issue? No. Okay.
Not as innocent as it seems.
Representative Murphy, do you want to do the A25? Replacing meth with drug in sheriff's literature.
Oh. Yes, that was something that my whole team kind of thought would be a good idea, because if we're successful with finding meth, then there might be a new drug coming along and we don't want to have to rethink everything. So I move A25.
825 is before us. Discussion. Representative Soderson, this was your bill. Do you want any discussion? Okay. On the A25 amendment for adoption, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. A25 is adopted. On the AO1 amendment, this would be, chair offers the amendment, this would delete the article on identity theft. I believe this is at the author's request. Representative Coles, you are in the room. We're about to discuss and vote on the AO1 amendment, which would delete the article on identity theft. Is that okay?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, as we discussed last week when I was here, as you and I discussed recently, the intent would be for that provision, the non-budgetary provisions of that. There was one article or one section of 2843, the section on the new card skimming crime that had a slight fiscal cost of $27,000 each year. That piece, the intention is to get rid of that eventually and move the bill on its own. The policy piece is on its own. The Senate bill passed out of the Senate yesterday, and I'd like to have this move on its own. So if members would be willing to pull this out of the omnibus bill, that would be my preference.
Well, let's proceed with processing the A1 amendment. Strip out your, delete your language, and then we may or may not get back to it later today this afternoon. Who wants to be heard? Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that this is an important piece, and in the event that you run into issues, Mr. Chair, would you be open to an amendment later on in the process, putting it back in this bill in the event that it doesn't make it out on its own?
I think history will record that a good way to get a bill passed is to have it rolled into the omnibus public safety bill, so you're welcome if you want to stay, but for now we'll move you out.
Thanks, Chair.
I'm willing. Any further discussion on this amendment? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Chair members.
Thank you. It is adopted. Representative Newman, AO4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a matter that came to me very late on March 30th of this year. The Becker District Court ruled that a predatory offender who was required to register for life in the state of California, who had moved to the state of Minnesota, was not obligated to comply with our lifetime registration statute. In that case, the court felt that there was an ambiguity in our statute. The purpose of the A4 amendment is to remove that ambiguity. It would be my intent to prevent the state of Minnesota from becoming, in effect, a sanctuary state where our laws regarding predatory offenders for life don't mirror the laws of a foreign jurisdiction. It would also allow the BCA to collect registration information on lifetime registrants who immigrate from other states into the state of Minnesota, and as I previously indicated, clears up the ambiguity that was found by the Becker District Court in the case that was decided on March 30th.
Representative Ellison.
Representative Smith, I have a question that might well be referred to Mr. Diebold. As I understand it, the offense, the sex offense for which a defendant is convicted is what determines lifetime registration as opposed to 10-year registration. And the level 3, 2, and 1 designation is something that is decided within the institution. And so I guess my question is, we already have lifetime registration, but that's based on what you're convicted of. And level 3 is a determination that's made later by the DOC. So, in effect, what I'm wondering is this amendment going to in any way interfere with what the DOC does? And is it, I guess I'm trying to figure out how is this going to impact our registration, our existing registration scheme? It sounds like it's going to switch it from the hands of one to another, or at least expand it from the hands of the courts to the DOC. Maybe somebody could clarify it for me. I'm not sure exactly how it will work. Maybe, and Mr. Lippman is here too, so maybe he knows.
Have a seat at the table. Please feel free to respond to the question at length, short length.
Mm-hmm. my history precedes me, Mr. Chairman. I'm Eric Lippman, the state sex offender policy coordinator. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, this wouldn't impact the risk level assignment, as you point out. The court for the 7th Judicial District in a case called Lucero said that lifetime registration in Minnesota can only be based upon Minnesota crimes. This was never the understanding, our understanding of that statute, which is if it was a comparable law to Minnesota law and you were obliged to register for life as a result of crimes in other states, you were likewise obliged to register for life in this state. Mm-hmm. The concern and the reason why myself and indeed the Attorney General's office and the various departments for which I work brought this forward and worked in collaboration in developing this language that Representative Newman has offered, is that we're concerned that Minnesota will become a relocation destination for lifetime registrants if their maximum, regardless of the crime that they committed elsewhere, is only a 10-year registration period in Minnesota. I believe that this was not intended by the legislature. This language cures it. We urge its adoption.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Lippman. Any other questions on the A4 amendment? On the A4, for adoption. Those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. A04 is adopted. Representative Johnson, do you have the A29-1? Go ahead.
I move the A29-1 amendment. This is Representative McNamara's bill on carbon monoxide detectors, and my understanding is that this is something that the parties have all worked out and that everyone is apparently happy with. It modifies the effective dates. It deletes the requirement that detectors be placed on each level of a residence, but it keeps the requirement that they be placed within 10 feet of sleeping rooms. And finally, it lessens some of the requirements on multi-unit dwellings to require that a detector be installed within 15 to 25 feet of a central carbon monoxide-producing fixture. And there are people here who can testify to this if we have questions.
Representative, go ahead. Representative Eason, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to offer an amendment to the amendment, if that is appropriate
state,
at this time, or if you
state
want.
State your amendment.
Basically, what I would like to do is I would like to restrict this requirement to new construction. And it's apparent to me that I think everybody is going to have to comply with this by the end of 2008, the way it looks like it's written in a residence. This is going to require every home in the state of Minnesota to go out and invest some money, whatever it is. It's going to be probably upwards of a couple hundred dollars to put in some carbon monoxide detectors. And I guess I just think that's a little bit onerous, and I think people can make those decisions on their own. And I think also most of the people that are going to install them will be using battery-operated ones, which batteries last 6 months maybe, and so there's going to be a continuously renewal, a monitoring issue, and I guess the question is are people really going to do that? Is it effective? If they're put in new dwellings, they're hardwired, and they're put in so for permanent operation. So I guess I would like to see this thing apply to new construction initially, and if we want to move beyond that in the future, we can come back and look at this at another legislative session. And Mr. Devo has given me some language that does that. If you want me to go through it, I will. But it basically, if you want to follow on the amendment, it's page 1, line 8, delete everything after 2007, and then delete line 9. And then page 2, line 3, delete everything after 2007, and delete line 3, four. All of line 4. And then on page 2, line 8, delete after everything after 2007, and delete line 2.9.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I see Representative McNamara is here, and this is his bill, so I would ask for his opinion on this.
Representative McNamara, take a seat at the table. Did you hear the offered amendment to the amendment or not?
You know, I didn't hear it, sir, Mr. Chair and members. My understanding is to gut the bill. I'm wondering, Mr.
Well, wait a minute, Representative McNamara. The question was, did you hear the description of the amendment to the amendment or not?
No, I did not, Mr.
Then I'm going to have staff give you the language so we don't launch off into speeches until we have the language down. Mr. Devo.
Chair and members, the amendment begins on page 1, line 8, delete everything after 2007, page 1, delete line 9, page 2, line 3, delete everything after 2007, page 2, delete line 4, page 2, line 8, delete everything after 2007, page 2, delete line 9.
And Mr. Diebel, what effect does that have relative to the issue?
Mr. Chair and members, the intent is to make the bill only apply to newly constructed homes and multi-unit dwellings, so that pre-existing homes would be exempt from the requirement of maintaining carbon monoxide detectors.
Representative McNamara, now you can make your speech. I'll be there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, what I would say is this amendment before you, the A29 amendment, is one that we've been working on real hard with the interest groups, both on behalf of the constituent, Mr. Griggs, who's here with me, who originally brought the bill forward because of the loss of his granddaughter. It has bipartisan support, both from myself, who lost my brother-in-law, in a cabin that was not a new cabin. It was built by my father-in-law 20 years prior to my brother-in-law's death. Representative Sertich lost a good friend just recently up north under the same situation. What we've done here is we've brought the interest groups together, both on behalf of the advocacy groups and the owners of the multifamily home, and those different groups together have worked very hard, a number of hours. And Representative Eastland, I apologize for my reference to gutting the bill. That was what I was told as I was walking in. I understand now you're not gutting the bill. You're just the applications and three deaths I just talked about would not get corrected under this scenario. I think that's a better way to put it. But, members, I would just ask that you not support Representative Eastland or the chair's amendment at this point, because this is a compromise, and I think it's a good bill that makes sense for us to deal with the opportunities before us to not have these unfortunate things happen in the future.
Thank you, Mr. McNamara. I guess I would say there's one interest group that I'm not sure was represented, and that's the interest group that represents all the homeowners in the state of Minnesota that are going to have to take on another $200 cost or so to accomplish this for the bill. So I guess any other questions or comments, Representative Soderstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to know from Mr. Debo if it's in law that you have to have a fire detector, or what do you call it? Smoke detector in every house? No.
Mr. Chair and members, my assumption is that they are required. I couldn't cite the statute, but I believe the fire marshal and plenty of fire safety people are here to answer that.
Sure. Is anyone here from the department that could answer that? Is it in statute or is it in building code, or where is the requirement for fire detectors right now? Anybody? We have somebody up here. Why don't you come up to the stand and tell us what welcome to the committee, Marshall Rosendahl. Would you state your name and you can respond to the question.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The members, Jerry Rosendahl, State Fire Marshal, and yes, that is the smoke alarm requirements for new and existing is in statute.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Representative Sarson?
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have another question. What is the cost of installing this carbon monoxide for not for a new house, but for an existing house? So then this would go into effect for every home, just like the fire.
Franzen, welcome to the committee. State your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Doug Franzen. I represent First Alert. The cost, again, depends on the house and if you choose a plug-in or a hardwire. Your average cost is about $25. You can pick up a wonderful smoke or CO detector for about $25 at Home Depot. Under the terms of the law, under the compromise agreement, I have a four-bedroom, fairly large house, and it would require me to have one $25 carbon monoxide detector in my home.
Representative Hilstrom has a question to that point.
No, to the fire person. But
okay, Representative Nelson, we'll go with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard a version of this this morning in jobs, and it went down in flames. So I don't oppose the bill. I just wish the date was farther out there. But the question I have in here, it says one on each dwelling or each level of the dwelling. So if you have a three-story, or you have a sleeping rooms in the basement and on the first and on the second floor, or a multi-floor, you're talking more than one smoke detector. Mm-hmm. And so $25, if you have multiple levels, you've got to multiply that times the number of levels. The way I understand it in the bill, so when you say it's only going to cost you $25 charge, if you have a multi-level house with sleeping rooms on each level, you're going to have multiple smoke or carbon monoxide detectors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, if I could refer you to line 1.10 of the amendment, we deleted on each level of the residency in the compromise. And Representative Sertich this morning was not aware that we had reached this compromise when he asked to bring the bill forward. The bill Representative Sertich brought forward was prior to the knowledge of the compromise. And then, Representative Nelson, you had brought forward when I had the bill before this committee previously that we had a date of, I believe it was August 1, 08, and we've lengthened that to August 1, 09 to address your concerns of giving more time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
But still, there has to be one outside of every sleeping room, even with the amendment. If there's multiple sleeping rooms on multiple levels, you're going to have one outside of every sleeping room or within 10 feet of every sleeping room. So, again, if you have bedrooms on multiple levels, you're still going to have multiple carbon monoxide detectors.
Representative McNamara.
Correct, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. If you had a four-bedroom home and they were on two different levels, you could have as few as two smoke detectors, or if the bedrooms happen to be on opposite ends of the room, you could have a four-bedroom home that conceivably could have as little as a $25 cost or as great as a $100 cost to incur.
Representative Cornish?
I guess, Mr. Chair members, first of all, I would say to Representative Nelson, what's your point? if it does cost more. I mean, I had a near-death experience of our family, too, when I was out working and came back to find the fire department running around with a bunch of sensors and fans in the house, and the kids staggering around with headaches, and we didn't have a monoxide detector at that time, which we do now. And just like everywhere, you have to start somewhere. And I've heard this bill before, and he has compromised Representative McNamara, and so I would oppose the amendment also.
To that point,
he asked me, you know,
Representative Nelson.
I guess the Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish. It's not, I'm not objecting to the additional cost. It's just to portray it as being only a $25 cost when you may have to have up to four or five in a house. Is, I think that's just not being totally truthful. That's why I wanted to point out that if you have multi, you've got to have one outside every bedroom. I just wanted to point it out so it's on the record so the committee understands that.
Okay. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These carbon monoxide detectors have been around for years and years. I've had one in my home for really a long time. I will tell you that it was simply a matter of going down to a local store, buying it, taking it home and plugging it into the wall. It's really no big deal in terms of acquiring one, and I would certainly think that any homeowner would want to have one in their home without the necessity of a statute being passed. Just as a thought, as a kind of a compromise between the amendment to the amendment that's now being offered, you could consider requiring carbon monoxide detectors in new construction and on the sale of a home, and leave homeowners to their own responsibility for providing a carbon monoxide detector in their private homes.
As the author of the amendment, I guess I would accept that. I mean, I think that's reasonable. I don't think it's reasonable to just mandate that everyone has to do that. But Representative Soderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was wondering if they know if other states have this law. Have they?
Franza? Or Representative McNamara?
You know, there are a number of other states, and I'm not sure I know the actual count.
There's six other states.
Would you state your name for the record, sir?
Excuse me. My name is Dave Griggs. And there are six states that have legislation like this, and several major municipalities like Chicago, St. Louis, New York City. Alaska was the last one to pass it 2 years ago.
Further questions, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually had a question for the fire marshal. He was down here previously.
Okay. Mr. Rosendahl, would you come back? And when he's returning to the table, were there any other questions? Otherwise, okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about the implementation of the rules with smoke detectors being required. I believe that it's if you make an expansion to your home or need a building permit or something, then you're required to make certain that you have the smoke detectors in however no one's going out or writing citations. Is that correct? Or?
Mr. Rosendahl.
Mr. Chairman, members, the changes to an occupancy, the upgrades, typically then that you're dealing with the building code and the building permit, and they, you know, would handle the enforcement, if you will, of that. Enforcement of this is would I guess relate to when we were in that type of an occupancy, we would be checking for that. But beyond us getting into that occupancy, I'm not sure whose responsibility is to do that.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then when you did change and require smoke detectors, does that change the liability or the responsibility in the event that there is a fire and a death? Can someone be at fault, or does that make any significant change, or did it, you know?
Mr. Rosendahl.
I'm looking to some of the colleagues that have been in the fire marshal division longer than I or in the fire service as long, and that is not spelled out in the statute in terms of liability. I don't have a good answer on that.
Okay.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Fire Marshal, can you, if there are there any programs that you're aware of so that people who are on fixed incomes or financially strapped can get a hold of some of these carbon monoxide detectors? Because it seems like cost is a factor here. Are they available for people who might have trouble affording them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I can speak to the smoke alarm situation. There are many programs, including in the State Fire Marshal Division, where purchase at a reduced cost, or in some cases, local fire departments have bought them and distributed them for free. Quite frankly, I don't know that the same situation exists in carbon monoxide detectors. However, I would just offer that after the law was put into place and fire service in general, you know, starts working fire prevention towards the smoke alarms, then the programs were borne out, and a similar program I'm sure could come about in on the carbon monoxide alarms also. But I don't have knowledge of those being available at the present time.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I believe other witnesses may have some information regarding carbon monoxide detectors.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, yes, that's been the experience in other states with at least our company. There are programs available to make sure that people who need these can get them.
Definite wall. Any further questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative McNamara because I expressed some concern. I still have some concern about the cost of this that's going to be on some of our local units of government that have public housing, because if they have, I mean, they're the large ones, the high rises that have central heating has been taken care of. But I know Minneapolis has between 2,000 and 5,000 scattered site homes that now they're going to have to, even if it's only one per unit, that's a lot of money that they're going to have to come up with to outfit these homes because they're rental units. St. Paul's in the same situation. I believe Duluth, some of the larger metropolitan area or cities have them. So that's a concern I have going forward with this. But like I said, Representative McNamara has worked with me on the one provision, and I think I don't oppose this. I've just got some concerns that we're putting an unfunded mandate out here on some of our local municipalities, and there's, going forward, we need to watch that.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, I wanted to just mention one more part of the compromise was the thoughts that many of these multifamily, large residential buildings have security systems and such involved in them, and we offer the opportunity, if they have a central heat system with maybe a boiler in the basement, they can tie it into that, and they won't have the mass expense of putting these units in each unit. They'll be able to tie it to where the actual threat will be. So we did try and draft the common sense good legislation.
Representative Nelson?
That's true, and I applaud you for that. That part of it, I support that part. But I'm talking more about the public housing units agencies have what they call scattered site, which are individual homes, which is like anybody else's home, and they're now going to have to go and they're going to have to retrofit all these with at least one and maybe multiple units in there. And again, at $20 to $25 a piece for those units, where if you're talking 5,000 units, that's a big chunk of change.
Any other comments to the amendment? I guess I would just like to, since I'm the author of the amendment, I would just like to say, I mean, I think I don't oppose what Representative McNamara is trying to accomplish. I guess what I struggle with is just the mandate that somehow we're just going to push this out and we're going to force everybody, no matter what their circumstances in life are, that they have to do this. So I think a logical place to start is with new construction, and if we want to expand that into renovations, and if we want to expand that into some kind of other area in the future, when there are some programs available to help people do that, I would be supportive of that. But at this time, I'd like to renew my amendment as it was stated. Representative Ellison?
One comment I have, Mr. Chair, is that You know, if we only do new construction, then what about all of the people who live in older homes? I mean, you know, a lot of times older homes are associated with lower income. Not always, but often that's true. And I'm just a little concerned that we might leave people who are vulnerable without the protection that this Representative McNamara's bill would provide. And I know that it's expensive, and I sympathize. That's why I asked about those programs. But it's pale in comparison to the loss of life. And so I guess I'm with Representative Cornish on this one.
Mr. Chair? Representative Cornish?
And I think it also could impact our low-income and our immigrant community more, too, because as Representative Ellison knows, lots of times in these dwellings you can have up to 8-10 people in a room trying to survive, and the loss is bigger, and I think they just deserve the protection also.
Representative Maslow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also inclined not to go with the amendment at this time, although I appreciate your thoughts and your efforts on it. I do want to clarify, though, have you modified your amendment as in terms of what we're voting on? Did you take Representative Newman's suggestion as a friendly amendment, or are we operating on your amendment as originally offered? I heard you call it friendly, but I don't think formally it was accepted.
I mean, I would be open to, you know, modifications similar to that. I guess what I'm opposed to is kind of the blanket approach.
Right.
That we just kind of bring this out and we have a requirement that everybody comply. I didn't hear anybody put together an amendment how it would fit, so I guess at this point I don't know how that language would look. But I guess my point is I would move the amendment as I offered it, and just in comment to some of the comments here. I mean, one of the issues that we're dealing with that makes this issue much more relevant than new houses is the tightness of the houses. And I think that's something that we were struggling with even in the building code all across the state. Houses are so tight, and there's ventilation systems. Older houses, although this can be an issue anywhere, older houses are much less inclined to have an issue unless there's some kind of a major problem. So, I guess everybody is entitled to be where they want to be on this issue. My amendment is that we limit it to new housing, and so if there's no other comment, I guess all those in favor of the amendment as offered, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
I think the noes have it.
Okay.
So back to the amendment, the A29-1 amendment. Any other comments on the A29 amendment? Okay, then all in favor of the A29-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Opposed.
No.
And the amendment is adopted. Okay, so next we're on the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
What are we, A47? The A47 amendment. And that is Representative Cornish. Want to tell us about your amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, the A47 amendment is basically, I had this bill before you, for another committee, we added an amendment. It does not change the classification, doesn't change the collection. All this is a redefinition and clarification. It does not change what left here. It just explains it better, so there's nothing scary in the amendment. The NIST, the Name and Index Service Data Classification.
Any comments on the A47 amendment? So all those in favor of the A47 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. So we're looking at the A39 amendment. Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and I apologize for the string that we're about to start here, but I'll try to move through it quickly. The A39 is strictly a technical fix to the Blakely provisions that we discussed in the bill that came forward. I would note that that what we talk about is restoring some stricken language on page 16, lines 30 and 31. And if you look at line 30, there is actually language stricken both at the beginning and end of that line. I am not intending to restore the language at the beginning of the line, rather the language at the end of the line, which would be been convicted of a second or, and then subsequent, continuing on line 31. That is a purely technical change, committee members.
Any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, then all those in favor. Oh, Representative Ellison. Okay.
If I may also clarify, I think that by striking that language on, or by restoring the language on lines 30 and 31, that would also mean striking the proposed new language on line 31 in order to make that all fit. Yeah, that would, I'm told that is correct.
Representative Ellison.
Representative Eastland. As I understand the amendment, Representative Neslow, it would require under Blakely that the jury or fact finder be required to find beyond a reasonable doubt whether there was a prior or subsequent offense. Is that right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison, the language, if we don't adopt the amendment, would address either a prior or subsequent offense.
Okay.
By restoring the language, we're only talking about prior offenses.
Okay. And
Representative Ellison?
And Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, as I understand it, Blakely states that the one thing a judge can find judicially is the existence of a prior offense. Is that right?
Representative Meslow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Ellison? Representative Nelson?
Just reading this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I didn't hear. I'm reading this on line 29. Do you need to replace or restore the on the last two words on that line or in that line to make it sound sensible? Or
Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't believe we need to, because what I indicated is that the language that appears at the beginning of line 30 would remain stricken. The only restored language is the language that is stricken at the end of line 30, continuing on to line 31. Thank you.
So any other questions of the committee? So we have the A39 amendment before us. All those in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that amendment is adopted. Let's go on to the A21 amendment. Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The A21 amendment expands a bill that I had offered that's included in our proposed omnibus bill that expands the class of offenses that can be included for purposes of enhancing subsequent convictions. Remember that already in that class are offenses such as domestic assault convictions, and violation of orders for protection and violations of harassment orders. Our bill now already includes language that incorporates language that would include violation of no contact orders. The A26 amendment would also bring in violations of, or would also bring in interference with 911 call, which is already a gross misdemeanor on a first offense, but it would mean a conviction of that offense would also be used for possible subsequent enhancement.
Any questions or comments from the committee? So on the A21 amendment, all those in favor of that signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the A21 amendment is adopted. We'll move to the A22 amendment. Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the A22 amendment again deals with domestic assault. As the law stands today, it is a felony to commit a domestic violence-related offense against the same victim three times within 5 years. This would remove the requirement that it be the same victim. This has been reviewed for fiscal impact, and the correction says they can absorb it.
So any questions, comments from the committee on the A22 amendment? Representative Dawson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, what's the state of the law now? I know that if you get a fifth-degree
domestic assault and you do it again, and you do, you, I know it's an enhanceable offense now. What this would do is it would turn it into a felony, no matter who, for different victims. If you get three, I mean, exactly, what does it do? How does it change the law?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, under today's law, it would be enhanced to a gross misdemeanor if it's the second offense within 5 years against any victim. It would be enhanced to a gross misdemeanor. I'm sorry, second offense within 5 years, same victim. It would be a gross misdemeanor second offense within 3 years against any victim. And under today's law, it would be a felony if it's third offense within 5 years, same victim. The only thing we're changing with this is the third of those, that if it is a third offense within 5 years, that would be a felony, even if it's a different victim, as long as they're all domestic.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? So then on the A22 amendment, all those in favor, signify by the same aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Okay, the A22 amendment is adopted. Then we have the A7-1, Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is from the county attorneys. It was a bill that we heard earlier. There was testimony pro and con on this issue, and it was under present law, there are increased penalties for someone who commits a sixth felony if the jury also finds that there is a pattern of criminal behavior. The testimony we heard from the county attorneys is that sometimes they've had trouble establishing that with a jury, and really we ought to find that if it's a sixth offense, that is a pattern, and that shouldn't be an additional requirement for a jury to have to consider in its final decision. We also heard from the defense bar that they think that, and from the public defender's office in particular, that they think that that should still be a requirement. I'm in agreement with the county attorney's office that once we've gotten a six, that's a pattern, and that should not be one additional thing for a jury to find. That was not included in the bill as it initially went into the omnibus bill, and frankly, I think that's a good thing because I think we should all be aware that we're consciously making that decision, and otherwise that might have slipped below the radar screen. It should be on our radar screen. I think we should be making this change, and I would encourage your support.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, so just to forgive me for being a little slow today, but as I understand the amendment, it would alleviate the responsibility of the state to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt the sixth offense.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, yes, that would no longer be an element for the state to prove in order to get the enhanced sentencing for a sixth offense.
Representative Ellison.
Are you concerned that that might be a Blakely problem and create a constitutional challenge?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I don't believe that it will be.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Well, Let me ask you, if we just require that the state prove the sixth felony to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, and assumingly there'd be certified records to prove all that, aren't we on a safer ground if we do it that way rather than this way? I mean, this way it seems like we could invite challenges, invite appeals. You know, if we just, aren't we inviting more litigation?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I think that's a valid question. I think that is why it's important for us to have this conversation at the table. I don't believe that this would create a Blakely problem. I do feel that when someone has committed their sixth felony offense, that it's appropriate for us to keep moving. I shouldn't say keep moving. It shouldn't be necessary for a specific finding that is a pattern, and that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about proving that there were five prior offenses. It's whether the state is required to prove specifically that it is a pattern. I would say that by definition it is a pattern, and we shouldn't have to require the state to make that additional step.
Maybe we could pause for a second here. This is an initiative of the county attorneys. Maybe we have Mr. Cahill could come up and give us some insight into this as well. Welcome to the committee, sir. State your name and give us your insights.
Pete Cahill, Chief Deputy Hennepin County Attorney. and I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. This is a County Attorney Association initiative. The intent here is to remove the pattern because that is a Blakely issue, as Representative Ellison has noted. And that requires us to prove beyond reasonable doubt the existence of a pattern. That does require sometimes impaneling a jury just for that issue. It also requires us to dig back into old criminal records to try and find fact witnesses to establish what happened. By doing this amendment, essentially what we're left with is the sixth felony conviction then entitles the judge to use their discretion, it's not mandatory, to impose a career offender sentence. Prior convictions under the Blakely specifically are not required to be submitted to a jury. A defendant still has the right to contest anything in the pre-sentence investigation and the existence of those five prior felony convictions. They can bring a motion for a contested sentencing hearing. It's just that it would not have to be done to a jury. It would have to be done to a judge. And to be honest, our experience to date is that when it involves prior convictions, most defendants have been waiving the jury on that because they really don't want to have the jury hear about their prior criminal record.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Cahill, you know, what is required? I mean, what is the proof that's required to show pattern? What would you have to argue? What would the state have to argue to a jury in order to establish a pattern?
Mr. Cahill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison. Actually, I think it's fairly broad because the definition of pattern is fairly broad. Patterns have been found when a person has a combination of theft and drug-related offenses, and that was considered a pattern. As I think I may have testified earlier in front of this committee, it seems to be establishing some type of criminal lifestyle. So there's no one way of proving that pattern. We have even resorted to calling the court administrators or assisting court administrators to testify about someone's criminal history, which has not pleased the courts. They have been a little concerned that we are calling their employees to testify as witnesses in cases before that they're adjudicating. But we've resorted to that as an example of how we are trying to prove pattern of someone's background.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Let me ask this, Mr. Cahill. Now, let's just say you have somebody who is 21 years old and gets charged with a multiple count complaint. Maybe they try to rob a store, get into a car, drive away, hit somebody, hurt somebody. So you could have assault, aggravated robbery, fleeing, police, that's three. Hit somebody, criminal vehicular operation, that's four. And I'm sure you guys could think of another one.
Unauthorized use of motor vehicle.
Unauthorized use of motor vehicle. Okay, now the guy is 49, and he gets a shoplifting because the coat that he took is $501 as opposed to $499.
Well, I think you're changing that to $1,000, but yeah.
Okay, you're right. Thank you. Good job. All right, $1,000 as opposed to $999. Does this apply?
Mr. Cahill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I actually appreciate that question because it does clarify. One point is that I believe it was the State versus Houston HUSTON case. The Supreme Court said that that would not kick in the career offender statute. It has to be a pattern of offense, conviction. They have to be discrete crimes which resulted in a sentence in between each one. Another example, if you had somebody who had been pulling burglaries and they finally get caught, and so they get five burglary convictions at one time, get five sentences on one day, that person does not qualify under 609.1095. It has to be offense, conviction, offense, conviction. And that's a good point, actually, in clarification, that although it's not in statute, it has been clarified by the Supreme Court.
So any more questions to the A7-1 amendment? Representative Seisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question, which I think you can probably answer, is what is the difference, and I should know this, if they call you a career criminal, how much is your sentence enhanced versus the person that is not labeled a career criminal?
Mr. Cahill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, the enhancement is up to the judge. The judge can do as little as a day. Because it's may and not the shall, the court has discretion to go anywhere from no departure up to the statutory maximum.
And Mr. Chairman, what is the statute? What's the maximum? I mean,
Mr. Cahill,
Mr. Chair, Representative Soderstrom, that depends on the crime. It's the statutory max that's within each individual offense.
I see no other questions to the amendment. We're looking at the A7-1 amendment. All those in favor of adopting that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, the A7-1 amendment is adopted. I think at this point we have session in 10 minutes, so we will be recess and we will be reconvening in this room at 4:30. And so take your materials with you, and maybe I should say we'll be reconvening at 4:30 or to the call of the chair. If the room becomes available earlier, it may be watch your emails and stay in touch so that if we could meet earlier, we will. But take your stuff with you, and this meeting stands in recess. Thank you.
I'd like to call back into order the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance today, April 11, 2006. We have a somewhat revised agenda, just as indicating which bills in bold have been brought before the committee thus far. I think we're at item number 33 on the list. So this would be the AO2 amendment for consideration, Representative Osment, Richfield Disabled Firefighter. The chair will move the AO2 amendment for adoption. It's before the committee. Go ahead, Representative Osment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I bring this amendment to the committee and to the chair for consideration because we have a situation where a firefighter who has a job-related disability has not been able to obtain health insurance. We have a program now in place where when the question of whether injury or disability is job-related, we have a panel that looks this over called the Public Safety Officers Health Insurance Reimbursement Program, and this panel actually makes the evaluation. And then we have a program set up to where I believe the cities are then reimbursed for the cost of this program. This particular firefighter was disabled prior to this program coming into existence and kind of falls between the cracks. Even though if he had this circumstance occur today, the determination would go to the panel to see if it was job-related or not. In this case, his appeal to his community said that they had made a determination that he was not job-related with regard to health care coverage, even though he is receiving online disability coverage from PARA and for his pension system. So this is kind of helping to provide him the opportunity to go before the panel and to see if the panel finds that his disability is job-related and therefore would provide him opportunity to become covered by health insurance. If it's not job-related, this legislation does not mandate the determination of the panel. It only gives him the opportunity to plead his case.
Thank you, Representative Osment. Any questions from the committee? All right. On the adoption of the AO2 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim.
AO8. Representative Powles, would you come forward on that one? Chair, I'll move the AO8 amendment. I'd like to have you explain it to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This amendment deals with Section 253B02, and it's related to child protection and a use of a drug during pregnancy for the purposes of civil commitment and child maltreatment. We've had some cases up in north central Minnesota where pregnant women are using two drugs, one called OxyContin and OxyContin, and a couple of counties are not looking at taking the newborn child in custody and doing tests on the mother to see if she's addicted to this or if there is child abuse. And the reason is that OxyContin and OxyContin is a derivative of opium. In the list of drugs that are used in that statute, we have cocaine, heroin, one I can't pronounce, and amphetamine, and methamphetamine. Opium, if we list that, then these two drugs are a derivative of opium, and it would then cover those two drugs, which evidently are a new fashion of drug used in north central Minnesota. And this was brought to me by
an intake and assessment social worker for the Leech Lake Family Services, which is a tribal social service agency in north central Minnesota.
Any questions of Representative Hollis on the AO2A8, excuse me, amendment? Discussion. On the amendment for on adoption, on the, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, we're going to go to the A32 amendment. The chair will move for adoption the A32 amendment. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for letting us bring our amendment before the committee to have it heard. You've heard this before. The bill was brought up before last year. And right now, members, you have an amendment in your packet. I have individuals here to testify on the amendment and just give you a little bit of concern or their brief statement on why we need the amendment.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Tom Workman with ABATE of Minnesota, which is American Bikers for the Awareness, Training, and Education of Motorcyclists. And this is, you're looking at what is our legislative piece for this year. We have been for years struggling to find ways when I and my friends are riding our motorcycles on a nice day like today down the road, and another vehicle takes a left or fails to yield in front of me and causes great bodily harm to myself and my passenger or death. We wanted to begin with this legislation to start the process to lay out a process for repeated failures for doing so. And the bill last year that Representative Anderson carried jumped right to felony. This one does not do that. This bill also does not, as in any violation on the road, force a law enforcement officer to write a ticket. It does not really tell the county attorney he has to prosecute something that a ticket wasn't written for. That seems to be another fairly big issue that is out there, and I could tell stories all day about that. That is what has been the genesis, though, of this bill is there are people who are minding their own business, whether they're on a motorcycle or a bicycle or in another car, and they are they're losing their lives due to failure to yield by other motorists, and not much is really happening to them. And so we wanted to begin the process to raise the awareness of this situation on the highways.
All right.
I'm Allison Hartle. I'm here tonight on my own behalf, and also as a founding member of the Board of Minnesota Bikes, a bicycle advocacy group in Minnesota. I am wholeheartedly in support, as is our organization, of this bill, and we really appreciate the author and former Representative Workman bringing it forward. We are, as bicyclists on the roadways, among the most vulnerable road users, and quite often, and I have a lot of folks that I ride with who have been the victims of motorists failing to yield to bicyclists. So I appreciate your time and attention to this amendment.
We have additional testimony pending, however, questions from the committee at this point. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a fiscal note on this?
Say again, please.
Is there a fiscal note on this bill?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, we have not requested one.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember hearing this previously, but is there a way to get the previous fiscal note on the bill that was similar from last year?
Mr. Deeple.
Mr. Chair and members, the bill last year had felony penalties, I believe, and so that it was probably a bad impact that was related to Department of Corrections, if I remember correctly. So this one wouldn't have that level of cost on the state penal system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pelstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But on line 1.13, there is a felony level provision. And that is for a person who is convicted within 5 years of committing a second crime.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I would assume that would take 5 years or at least several years to, and the out would be the cost would be in out years, and so it wouldn't be an immediate fiscal note on that felony because you'd have to have repeat violations and convictions.
Representative Hamer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Diebel, I guess I don't know the statutes on traffic violations like I should, but are there accidents that a driver could be charged criminally for not when there's not gross negligence? I'm just thinking of subdivision one. Someone makes that's an accident and it's not under the influence or not. I mean, are there other kinds of moving violations that they would be charged, could be charged with a misdemeanor?
Mr. Duval.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamer, I would imagine failure to stop at a stop sign, running a red light, things like that would be presumptive penalties where you wouldn't need to be showing in criminal intent, really.
And could be charged with a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
With
Mr. Nebel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, if there's bodily injury and which is based on some sort of bodily injury, they're not just running the red light, that's not going to be the misdemeanor, but with the assumption that it's related to or causes bodily injury, that's when it would escalate to a more severe penalty than a petty misdemeanor.
Thank you.
All right, we have Representative Newman and then Ellison. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, had you invited comment on this bill, or are we still taking testimony? I do want to comment on the bill, but I don't want to speak out of turn.
I guess I'd prefer to finish with these testifiers by way of questions from the members. There is at least one other testifier on the bill. Then we can go to discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions of these witnesses? Representative Ellison, did you have questions of these witnesses?
Actually, no.
Okay, let's see if we have additional. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe you could just give us about a 30-second explanation of the genesis of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll turn that back over to Mr. Workman.
Representative Eastland, it's been a long time genesis, I guess.
30 seconds.
I didn't say I was going to speak long. Again, as Ms. Hartle stated, bikers are a little more vulnerable than most. And this is not specifically a biker bill. This is any motorist. In fact, I can give you a story in the last 2 months about a truck driver that was killed this way also. What's happened is I'm out with my wife, I'm coming to an intersection, and what traditionally happens is the automobile coming my way turns right in front of me, and I'm going that way if I haven't already hit the car, and now I'm severely injured and I am or dead. And I could probably fill the room with people who've had this happen to them. And what really was the genesis was they're finding out that because I'm dead at the street level, God bless the police officer has to be on the scene. He's not writing a ticket. So what's happening is, and that's where I can fill the room with people that can say they failed to yield, they turned right in front of me, I'm dead, no ticket written or anything, and so the bikers of Minnesota repeatedly said we have to begin to raise the specter of this so-called accident because people are dying and nothing is happening. And so, again, this bill does not, if a police officer pulls me over and I'm intoxicated, I don't believe there's a law that says he has to write me a ticket. He can let me go home, I suppose. So that's the fluidity of the law. But, and this bill does not say he's going to have to write me a ticket. I don't know how that would be worded. But the bikers want to begin the process of raising this specter of this so-called accident that is occurring by people just willy-nilly turning in front of a motorcycle or a bicyclist. If I do that in front of a 18-wheeler, my mistake, I'm dead. But that's not how it happens for the biker. The biker is most assuredly the one that gets harmed. And so we're asking the legislature, we've asked Representative Anderson to begin to raise the specter of this is a common occurrence that you would like address.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a woman who was recently like 80 or 90 years old in my district, and she was crossing the street with her walker, and someone failed to yield to her in the crosswalk, and she died. Would that apply to this?
Opinion? Anyone?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Let's ask you to stand down. Let's take another testifier. And in the meantime, Representative Meslow, did you want to be recognized?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, if I could, I'd like to respond to the question that Representative Kamar was asking earlier. A petty misdemeanor traffic offense can be treated as a misdemeanor under two different circumstances. One is if the driving conduct endangered people or property, including the driver and the driver's vehicle. The other is if it's a fourth moving violation within a year. So those are the two ways that it becomes a misdemeanor. Under current law, that kind of a violation could become a felony if it is either done in reckless disregard and there is bodily injury or death, or if the driver is under the influence of alcohol and there is bodily injury or death.
Representative Kamar. Representative Maslow, I just want to make sure Mr. Workman just said that he thought that Representative Hillstrom's comment about the crosswalk violation fit in this, and I'm not sure that it does, and I'd like some clarification if that's considered a failure to yield a right-of-way. I mean, this is a big issue too. I don't know if Mr. Representative Anderson, you wanted to address that in your bill, but
well, Representative Meslow, go ahead and respond if you want.
I'd like to take a shot, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kamar. I believe that it would be covered by the language of the bill. First, obviously, under today's law, that would be a misdemeanor violation, assuming that it wasn't reckless behavior, assuming the driver wasn't under the influence of alcohol. I believe it would be covered by the bill because under Minnesota law, a person who is using the crosswalk legally has the right of way. And so by definition, if that person is then struck when they are properly using the crosswalk, the person striking them would have to have failed to yield that right of way.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Can we go here? Do you, Representative Newman, go ahead.
To that point, Mr. Chair, members, the bill in front of us does make reference to 169.201, which is the question Representative Paymar is raising, and it addresses any pedestrian legally crossing the roadway. So I would assume that would be in the road, in the crosswalk, and that reference is in the bill.
Let's go to our next witness, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Pete Cahill, Chief Deputy Hennepin County Attorney. I'll be here on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association again. I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention that the Criminal Law Committee of the association looked at this and opposes the bill primarily because the failure to yield is such a wide variety of conduct. It involves everything from a dump truck who sees a red light 600 feet away and still decides to go through it, hits a car and kills someone. That's actually a case I had that I prosecuted as a gross negligence criminal vehicular homicide. It also goes to someone who stops at a stop sign, looks both ways, but because of the sun direction didn't see someone coming, pulls out and causes an accident, purely unintentional. This is a tough area of law, we recognize. The harm is sometimes very great, but intent is sometimes lacking, and even recklessness is even lacking.
And so because of the broad nature of it, we would prefer the current statutory scheme, where instead of focusing solely on the harm, we focus on whether it's gross negligence or negligence and have the case charged accordingly.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cahill, I was driving my cycle down the highway about 55 miles an hour, and this guy come up to the stop sign, pulled right out in front of me. I slammed into the side of his vehicle, did a double Sukahara over the top of the car, and rolled on the highway and took a gouge out of my head. And he drove away after meeting and didn't even get a ticket. Would this help that doorknob to actually pay a price, this law that was in effect, and so he'd pay the penalty that he deserves?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, actually he could be charged with a misdemeanor under current law, failure to yield that was under circumstances that endangered life or property. So that could have been charged as a misdemeanor just on that basis, if there was a failure to yield.
Representative Cornish?
And then terminology, these aren't really accidents. Somebody looking into the sunlight and not seeing anybody isn't really an excuse. The Highway Patrol is not allowed to call them accidents anymore. They have to be called crashes, and that's what they are. Regardless of what the reason is, when they pull up to the stop sign, sunlight in their eyes or not, that's one of the reasons for this law. So when they pull up there, they don't use that for a lame excuse, and they know there's a penalty involved. Maybe they'll start seeing motorcycles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, and I didn't mean to imply that that's all right to use as an excuse. It still is criminal behavior. It's still negligence, and so it can be punished and should be punished accordingly. It's more a matter of proportionality.
Discussion? Questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Cornish, what's a
Sukahara?
That's a fancy double flip over the top of a car. It's 50 miles an hour. People say I'm still suffering from that head injury, but
is that what caused it?
Okay, where were we at? Representative Allison, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith or Mr. DeBolt, is there any requirement under Minnesota law for motorcyclists to wear protective headgear at this time?
Mr. Chairman?
Whoever knows, actually.
Mr.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, no, there's not.
Under 18?
Under 18, oh, under 18, but I mean, actually. So.
Under 21.
You go there. Questions? All right, then, on the amendment. On the 832. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to comment on this amendment, and while I do understand the reason why this amendment is coming forward, I've got to urge the committee to look very, very seriously, carefully at this law. I think it is well-intentioned, but misguided. Essentially what this bill does, what this amendment is doing, is to criminalize ordinary negligence, not gross negligence, ordinary negligence. Ordinary negligence is simply the failure to use reasonable care. And there isn't a person in this room that has ever operated a motor vehicle who has failed to, on occasion, use reasonable care. So I just can't agree that we are going to create a new class of lawbreakers, either gross misdemeanor or felons. This is potentially has the ability to make someone a felon because they were careless. And in my mind, there is a huge difference between being careless and intentionally hurting someone. So while I am sympathetic to someone who is injured, I just cannot go so far as to criminalize ordinary negligence. I just can't do it. Second point that I want to make is with respect to former Representative Workman, he referred to bodily injury as being severe injury and death. This bill does not refer to that. It refers to bodily injury. Under 609.02, there are three categories of injuries. There is bodily injury, substantial bodily injury, and great bodily injury. The A32 amendment refers to bodily injury, which is simply pain or injury. It is the lowest of the classifiers of bodily injury. So, you know, all in all, when I look at the A32 amendment, again, I'm sympathetic to folks who are injured. But if you were to pass this amendment, I really sincerely believe that what you are going to do is criminalize ordinary negligence. And I just disagree with that concept. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Further discussion on the... Excuse me, Representative Messel, did you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with Representative Newman's comments, although I've phrased it just a little bit differently, because I don't think we are actually talking about criminalizing anything. I think it's important that we understand that what the behavior that we're talking about in the A32 amendment is already a crime. What we're talking about is what Mr. Cahill referred to as proportionality. We're saying that we're going to take negligent behavior and make it a gross misdemeanor or a felony. It is already a crime. I have actually prosecuted a number of cases under the existing statute, and jail time has resulted in those cases. It has resulted from those cases. But I am concerned when we take negligent driving behavior and make it a felony. I'm not aware of any other, certainly, driving behavior where negligence can result in a felony. I'm not certain, frankly, when we're talking about a negligent discharge of a firearm, whether that, if somebody's killed in that situation, that may very well be a felony. It's just not something I've dealt with, so I can't speak to that. But that would be the only example I could think of where that could be a step that we've taken. But it's a pretty significant step we're taking when we say we're going to make this potentially felony conduct. And I just, as tragic and as wrong as the losses can be in those situations, I think that as I look at the behavior, I don't think that that properly belongs in the felony category. And for those reasons, I'm not supporting the amendment at this time.
Representative Cornish.
Well, what worries me is then we're going to get into what's negligent and what isn't. I mean, if we accidentally leave our kid in the car too long and it dies of heat stroke in a car, or if we accidentally leave a vicious dog in our front yard and it kills somebody, or if we accidentally discharge a firearm and it kills a kid, I mean, all of these things that seem to be accidents or a little bit of negligence, I think they deserve an enhanced penalty, and I think this is the same. Great bodily harm or death, I think that certain crimes deserve, and this is a crime. It's not mere negligence to pull out in front of somebody and cause great bodily harm or death. And so I think the legislation is warranted.
Representative, if there's no further questions, Representative Anderson will go to you for a closing comment, and we're going to vote.
Well, Mr. Chair, as was mentioned by several members of the committee here, that maybe if we were to redefine bodily harm, such as great bodily harm or serious bodily harm, or as in the case of a felony, go to a serious bodily harm or death. I don't know if that would satisfy the members more so to have those identifiers in there, or to give further definition to what we're looking at. And maybe there's a definition in law that really brings out what those particular great bodily harm or serious bodily harm actually are. So if they're already in a law right now, this would just go back and forth on what we have, and we can use that. I guess it's the pleasure of the committee to say if they would be willing to go along with an amendment like that.
On the question of adoption of the 832 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Hillstrom, A42-1, CHIP County Cost.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the A42 amendment is drafted to the wrong page, number, and line. So staff, while I explain, can get the correct page, number, and line. That would be helpful. There was a CHIPS task force, and the goal was to take a look at the appointment process of the public defenders. And in the bill is kind of part of a compromise saying that CHIPS attorneys could not, or the public defenders could not be awarded to anyone except the custodial parent. And the counties did not approve of that because they then realized that their expense, they would be paying the cost of these attorneys being appointed. So there is an amendment, the A42, which has brought the counties on board. The problem is the courts don't like this as well. The reason there was a task force is because they needed to make recommendations, and the recommendation was to fund public defenders so they could represent everyone. And the fact is we don't have that kind of money in our target. So I offer the A42 amendment to at least get two of the three on board.
All right, we're looking at the H2953A42-1.
Let's get that on the record.
But there's language that they're supposed to be deleting.
What's the question?
Have you got the 42-1?
Yes. But it says on page 71, line 17, insert. But it's my understanding that there was language in the bill that needed to be deleted. Is that not correct? Yes. No, there wasn't. Okay. Mr. Chair, apparently the original language was not in the bill, so we don't need to delete it. So this is just an insert, and then it's fine.
Okay. On the amendment, is there testimony? Anyone wanting to be heard on this amendment? Raise your hand. I don't see anyone. Discussion on the 42-1. Discussion, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Newman left me with the instructions to argue against the amendment.
Argue with him.
But his hieroglyphics are faint and scribbled here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bills.
I could pretty much say that probably Representative Newman is opposed because he probably wants the court to have the discretion to appoint these attorneys. And I believe that, in fact, the court should have the discretion to appoint these attorneys when needed. The fact is we're not funding it. And so you can't appoint attorneys that no one is paying for. So I would rather that we fund them, but again, there isn't any money. So last year we saw this in an attempt to not have the children represented, and they were going to allow the parents to be represented. But I feel that it's more important to have the children represented and then the one custodial parent rather than multiple custodians or guardians or non-custodial parents.
Anything further?
Mr. Chair, his notes say it continues to expand the role of the attorney's salaries paid for at taxpayers' expense. Not a constitutional mandate. Genesis, Miranda decision. He talked about Wilmer, one juvenile and 17 people in the courtroom. Now, if you could make sense of that. But anyway, he wanted to oppose it. I've done my part.
Just one last final statement, Mr. Chair. This actually is reducing the number of attorneys that are going to be assigned rather than increasing. This is saying that currently people who right now get attorneys are not going to, not everyone is going to get them. So.
Are you going to anything further? Does Representative Newman have anything further?
That's about it.
On the amendment, then, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Mezel's not here, so we'll go to the next item, A50. 50-1. The chair offers the amendment. Is Mr. Erdman present? This is a technical change on the Fire Safety Fund bill that was made just this morning in another committee, and I'd like Mr. Erdman to identify himself and briefly describe what's happening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Henry Erdman, representing the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. This is language that was worked out in consultation with the Department of Revenue and their preference to have this section recodified under the Department of Revenue section. As you heard in testimony previous on this bill, this is a joint effort between the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, the state Fire Marshals Association, and other interested parties in the Department of Public Safety, and this cleans up the language and makes it easier for the Department of Revenue to collect and administer the surcharge.
Mr. Erdman, refresh my memory. Was not also there an amendment? Was there an amendment to this amendment dealing with the appropriation issue and the appropriate committee in the legislature? Were you there for that?
On state government finance this morning?
Yes.
Yes, there was. It would be the same exact amendments, and this would conform to that as well.
So that the appropriation would be tracked through this committee in the House?
Correct. Okay. Actually, if you look on, it took out where it says $250,000, Mr. Chairman and members, to go to the Department of Revenue to administer. I don't have that actual language in front of me presently, but I think Mr. Diebel would have that.
This is how it left. Can you point out the changes, Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, in the State Government Finance Committee this morning, there was an amendment that is reflected on page 2 of the 50-1 amendment under the subdivision 3 on lines 2 through 6. It's struck most of the language from that subdivision, which called for the Department of or Commissioner of Public Safety to manage the funds. This would allow for the funds to sit in the account, but for the legislature to appropriate it.
Any further questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this the provision that requires this bill to go to taxes? And did you fix it so it doesn't have to go there?
Representative Hillstrom, I think the answer is yes on your first question, that it does have to go to taxes, and it'll be fixed at some point as well. I'm not sure what any other causes may exist as to why this is going to taxes, but that is its route. Any other questions? All right, on the amendment. Those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Thank you. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Erdman. Representative Messler, A09. Adding fence to 609.3453, Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This simply clarifies, this has to do with the criminal sexual conduct statutes, and we're adding the word offense because that rolls in the criminal sexual predatory conduct that we've referred to before. So that's why the additional statutes rolled in, and that's why it's called offense. That's just a cleanup.
Any questions on the A09? If not, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The A09 is adopted. Representative Meslow, since you're talking, do you have an oral amendment at this point?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. If committee members will refer to page 33 of the bill, that's under Article 3, Section 4, and it is part of the language that came out of the second chance bill that was presented here in committee. This has to do with, the language here has to do with deferred sentence for first-time drug offenders. Under existing law, the court has complete discretion as to whether or not to defer, to permit a deferred resolution of the case. The language of the bill has the court following up on that a little bit more. And the original language that was presented in the bill that we heard in committee said a couple of things. One is that it said that there would be a presumption for a deferred sentence. The other is that the court would need to enter written findings demonstrating substantial and compelling reasons not to give a deferred sentence. There were actually three changes that I intended to make to that language in House File 2953. Two of those are incorporated here. One of them is that it allows the judge to make the ruling, to make the decision either in writing or orally on the record. The second is that I pulled out the presumption. The third change that I intended to make is not reflected, and that is my oral amendment. On page 33, line 20, it still indicates that the judge is to indicate substantial and compelling reasons why a deferral is inappropriate. I do think that that sets the bar too high. I think it's important that we have judges articulating reasons why a deferral would be inappropriate. And so I do think it's important that we're making a change and that we are asking the judge to not simply issue an arbitrary decision because I said so. But I think the substantial and compelling raises the bar too high, and therefore it is my oral amendment to remove the words substantial and compelling from page 33, line 20.
Any questions of Representative Messel? Representative Ellis.
Mr. Chair, so in other words, line 3320 would just, well, starting 3319 would just state, number two, state orally on the record or enter a written finding that states reasons why. That would just, so all the judge has to do is give a reason.
Representative Messel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, yes, that's my intention.
Okay.
Further questions? Any questions? On the oral amendment.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
So, Representative Meslow, what's to stop a judge from giving a frivolous reason? I mean, you know, I'm sure that would rarely happen, but in the cases that it might, you know, what would happen in that case? Because I said so is a reason. Because I wear the black robe, that's a reason. Could you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I don't think that would comply with the statute or either the language or intent of the statute, and I don't think that stands up. I think there could be a myriad of reasons, and some of the reasons we might like better than others, but I think that a legitimate reason is what needs to be put forward, and I think that is clear from the language.
Anything else? Any other questions on the oral amendment? There's no discussion. Those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Which one are we on? Hang on, sir. Chair, I'll offer the amendment. Mr. Lipp, would you identify yourself for the record and then explain this amendment, please?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. I'm John Lipp, appearing on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. We appreciate, Mr. Chairman, your willingness to bring this issue before the committee. This amendment is being proposed by the nursing facility industry in Minnesota, and it makes a few changes to a law that was enacted in 2005 that we hope will make that public safety policy provision more effective. There are three elements to the amendment. Under current law, registered predatory offenders must notify nursing homes of their registered status upon admittance. That's the language from the current law. And they must also notify their corrections agent or law enforcement once inpatient admission has occurred. The first element of the amendment is to push that notification farther upstream and to require the predatory offender to identify himself prior to moving into a nursing facility. There is a pre-admission screening process that everybody has to go through before being admitted to a Medicaid nursing facility, and we think there would be an opportunity for the notice to be given at that time. And providing the notice sooner, we believe, would give nursing facilities a better opportunity to judge whether placement of the offender in their care is appropriate. Second, if a nursing facility under the current law receives notice that it has admitted a registered predatory offender, the facility is required by the existing law to notify its residents of this fact. Those are all of the words that exist in the statute. And this has presented a problem to our members for a couple of reasons. First, facilities have interpreted their obligations under HIPAA to prevent them from identifying who the offender is or anything else about them. And the result of this is facilities feel that they can only give a generic form of notice. All they can tell their residents is, we have admitted an offender, period, which they believe can do more harm than good. Furthermore, when the notices occur, there are questions that come back that are sort of questions that would require some expertise in the criminal law, and our nursing facility employees don't have access to the information, and they're not trained or very well equipped to give it. So with this amendment, if an offender is placed into the care of a nursing home, the nursing home would obtain a fact sheet from law enforcement and would distribute that to residents instead. Finally, the current law requires notification of nursing facility residents upon admission of an offender, regardless of whether the offender has a risk classification. And we don't know, we believe that, whether that was intentional last year. If it was, we certainly can honor that. We think it might have been inadvertent. That would include probationers, people that have never gone to prison, and juveniles as well. So there is a clause in one of the paragraphs of the amendment that says if the offender has a classification, then the notice will be distributed. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry for the length of the presentation. I'll just add that the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the chiefs of police are fine with this amendment, and I've also been informed by Mr. Lipman that the governor's office supports the amendment as well.
Questions from the committee? Representative Filstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will this stop the Department of Corrections from placing offenders in nursing homes?
Mr. Litz.
Mr. Chairman, I am not intimately familiar with the policies of the Department of Corrections, but I do suspect that after the debacle at the Concordia Care Center, that the Department of Corrections will be very, very cautious, as I hope will members of our association, the industry, before affirming such a placement.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess mine's a little different. What about somebody that's not in a prison, but, you know, that's a registered offender? Could this prevent them from getting into a nursing home and getting the care that they need for their illness or their disability?
Mr. Laird.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, nothing in this amendment would prevent an offender from receiving the care that they need on any sort of default basis or across-the-board basis. What we are attempting to do is to provide nursing facilities with as much information as they can get ahead of time to determine whether they can provide the appropriate care and, most importantly, the appropriate level of supervision. But there's nothing here that would establish a rule that across the board no registered predatory offender could obtain treatment. And, in fact, we wouldn't want to do that because there are going to be instances where even a heinous criminal will be comatose or will be immobile and indeed will present very, very little risk, if any, to other residents. And in that case, a health care policy would support taking them.
Representative Nelson?
I guess that was where I was going. It was more the concern that somebody that is in that condition and needs the care, that the nursing home facility could use this as a possible way to not allow them to take one of their limited beds.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nelson, just to be clear, I believe there will be, potentially instances when a nursing facility receives some facts about the individual's crime, perhaps the profile of the victims, and so on. I think there are instances when this information will be a factor in a decision not to admit an individual. I think that could happen. But I think that's that is, in fact, our goal in some cases.
Any further questions? Representative Murphy.
Well, on that line, then, will there be some place, then, that that individual can go if they've been refused? Will there be another facility that they can be referred to for care?
Mr. Lips.
Are we just saying, no help here?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, each of these situations is going to be very unique. I suspect that in almost all cases that somebody that is trying to aid a registered offender to find a place for care will be able to do so, even if they're not successful with their first phone call or their second phone call. There has been some discussion, maybe a lot of discussion, about this issue and whether a forensic nursing home of some variety should be developed, either state-operated or privately operated through a contract with the state, etc. I think there may be instances when an individual has difficulty finding a place to have care, but I believe that in most cases some resolution can be found, but I don't know how to predict any better than that.
Further questions? Any other questions? On the A16-1 amendment, discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. And
Chairman and members, thank you.
Is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Lips. Representative Newman, A11. I do have that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is the no-fault reform bill that I had brought before the committee earlier this session. I remember at the time Representative Nelson had some questions concerning who was primarily responsible for insurance coverage. And during that hearing and then again after, I think I answered the questions that Representative Nelson had. I would remind the committee that this bill only applies to someone who is drunk, is not in, struck by, or actually maintaining a motor vehicle. Under this bill, we are not addressing blame. You can still get drunk and drive into a bridge abutment, and no-fault benefits apply. You can get drunk and change the car or the tire on a car and be injured, and no-fault benefits still apply. You can still get drunk and walk across a crosswalk, get struck by an automobile, and no-fault benefits apply. This simply establishes a situation in which where someone is intoxicated, you have separated yourself from that vehicle, gone off and fallen asleep and passed out, and no-fault benefits under that set of circumstances does not apply. And it is my belief that this makes sense, and it's good public policy not to have no-fault benefits apply when, in fact, the injury is not arising out of the maintenance and use of a motor vehicle. That's just simply where I am coming from on this thing, and it's my feeling that this makes good public policy. And I would move its inclusion.
Representative Ellis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, what if the vehicle, what if you use the vehicle to get where you ended up ended up getting injured outside the vehicle? So, for example, in the Dougherty versus State Farm case, what if what if the person used the vehicle to get where they ended up getting out of the vehicle and being therefore in a dangerous situation? In that situation, wouldn't you say that the vehicle was used and was crucial to the person being put in a dangerous situation?
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Representative, there's a whole series of cases that involve when someone is alighting from a vehicle or getting into a vehicle. And I don't think that this bill addresses that type of a situation. For instance, you may be concerned about someone that is intoxicated driving down the freeway and has a flat tire, gets out of the car to begin changing the flat tire. This bill doesn't address that type of a situation at all. This bill addresses a situation similar to the Doherty case, where the individual is not only intoxicated, but voluntarily leaves the vehicle and begins walking home. And the injuries haven't got anything to do whatsoever with an accident. The injuries have to do with the fact that the person is intoxicated and is now a pedestrian.
Go ahead. Representative Ellison, we appear to have by osmosis a witness preparing to testify, and I'm preparing to let him do so.
Well, Mr. Chair, as long as I can come back.
That'd be fine. We can. Sir, give us your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Will Flegel. I teach the Law School for Legislators. I'm an attorney in private practice in Minneapolis. I currently serve as the president of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association, and I have been for 8 years on the Minnesota Supreme Court's No Fault Standing Committee, which supervises no-fault law and its operation in the state of Minnesota. And I speak in opposition to the A11 amendment, which I believe would insert fault into the No-Fault Act. I believe that it may be worthwhile to give committee members a very brief background into the Doherty case and into the operation of no-fault law with the chair's indulgence. This bill seems very specifically drafted to undo a Minnesota Supreme Court decision, Doherty versus State Farm, which Representative Ellison referred to. Very briefly, the Doherty case involved a woman who had become intoxicated. She was driving home in a snowstorm. Her car crashed, and she left the car trying to seek out aid. In the course of her effort to get to aid, she sustained frostbite and sought payment of her medical bills under her no-fault policy. For those of you not familiar, no-fault is that portion of the motor vehicle insurance coverage in Minnesota which covers your medical bills regardless of whether one is at fault or not for an accident. It serves as a ready source of compensation. Our concern is for unintended effects on others who may be able, under current law, to advance claims in this case. And as Representative Newman referred to, there is a great body of insurance law that is somewhat complicated and very involved, which tries to delicately balance the countervailing interests that apply here. But among the cases which our courts have repeatedly ruled that there is a right to apply to one's own no-fault insurance coverage for benefits include slipping on ice after returning from closing a garage door, slipping on ice after attempting to fuel one's vehicle, injured while exchanging information at an accident scene, changing a tire, and so forth. The language in the A11 amendment limits coverage to circumstances in which a person is in, upon, or struck by a motor vehicle if that person happens to be intoxicated. Obviously, someone changing a tire would not be in the vehicle or upon the vehicle. Also, if you're walking back from your garage or from your fueling position, or if you're in the situation of Ms. Doherty, her vehicle became stranded in a blizzard and she was walking for help, these are circumstances that would not be covered. The Doherty case, in its final iteration at the Minnesota Supreme Court, represented the ninth time that for nine judicial opinions on the issue, ruling that under current Minnesota law, even though it was unattractive to some of the judges that someone who was intoxicated would have insurance coverage, that as balancing the question of who should pay for the medical bills, it was deemed to be more prudent public policy to have it be the private policy of insurance that the woman had paid for and secured herself, rather than make the responsibility for paying the medical bills fall to, for example, her employer's health insurance coverage if she had been insured, or if she lacked insurance coverage, government welfare benefits instead paying. And the public policy seemed, according to the court, to support the exercise of insurance coverage being the responsibility of the policy that she had privately paid for and secured the premiums on. While we understand that the idea of making car insurance available to intoxicated persons may be unpalatable, as it was to some members of the court, the medical bills have to go somewhere, and it seems that car insurance should be the entity responsible if the matter, in the opinion of a judge, arose out of the operation of a motor vehicle. And as I said in Doherty, the trial court judge, three court of appeals judges, five judges of the Supreme Court determined that that was the case. There is an elaborate test, and I will not take the time to go through it at this point, but one of our concerns is that this makes some significant alterations of a body of insurance law, and I think it would be prudent to have the matter evaluated by a committee that focuses on insurance issues, just to assure that something inadvertent isn't being done here. We believe that the current law is the better solution, as it provides to the trial judge the discretion to apply a test and determine, one, whether there is an extent of causation between the motor vehicle and the injury that makes it provident to make insurance coverage on the vehicle apply, whether an act of independent significance has occurred which broke the chain between the use of the vehicle and the injuries inflicted, and this, as I said, was the determination of nine judges, or whether the vehicle is being used for a transportation purpose or not. Those are things which we think will vary from case to case depending upon unique facts, and therefore it would be appropriate to let those decisions be made on an individual basis rather than to prescribe and say that the fact of intoxication deprives anyone under any circumstance of having access to insurance coverage if they are outside their vehicle. For these reasons, we would respectfully oppose the A11 amendment. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee.
You're welcome. Any questions of this witness? Thank you. Representative Ellison.
You know, Mr. Chair, I actually got a copy of the case that seems to be inspiring the statute, the amendment. That's the Doherty case. And I just want to read to the committee one part of it that I think sort of speaks to all sides of the question. And it says here, and I quote, "Our No-Fault Act does not contemplate fault, and intoxication is clearly related to fault. While Doherty's intoxication should not be condoned, here it is simply not relevant to the No-Fault Act. What is relevant is that Doherty's use of her vehicle placed her in a dangerous situation, stranded and exposed to the bitter cold, and she was injured while removing herself from that dangerous situation." So, you know, I just want to say that, you know, when somebody's, you know, drunk or whatever, it doesn't help them get sympathy for their situation, but I think that it would do more damage to the no-fault system to adopt this amendment than it would to send a message that we don't condone use of alcohol. So I would urge, I don't intend to support the amendment, and I hope members don't either.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would adding this provision to the bill make a complete repeal of no fault germane to this bill?
Representative Hilstrom, I don't have the definitive answer. I suspect it would open it up for such an amendment. Unless someone wants to disagree with that, that'd be my thought. Further discussion? Any other testimony on this bill? Anyone in the audience? I see none. I'm sorry. Is there anyone present who wants to be heard on this issue? Raise your hand now so we can see who else wants to testify. You want to have a... on the amendment. All right. Back on the amendment, it looks like. Representative Newman.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Thank you, Mr. Flugel, for coming here and testifying today. And once again, I want to remind the committee that I am also a member of the organization that Mr. Flugel is the president of. Just a couple of quick comments. In this particular case, the lady in question, Ms. Doherty, I would not agree that she was seeking aid. What she was doing is she was within a block of her home. She was in the process of walking home. I would also remind the committee that the Minnesota No Fault Act is your statute. And we have the absolute right to disagree with what the judicial branch of this government interprets the meaning of operation and use of a motor vehicle. And so you are able to do with this bill and with this statute whatever you desire. And if you come to the conclusion that under the facts outlined in the Doherty decision, her frostbite arose out of the maintenance and use of a motor vehicle, then vote against this amendment. If, on the other hand, you come to the conclusion that this lady received frostbite as a result of an act that didn't have anything to do whatsoever with the operation and maintenance of a motor vehicle, then I would urge you to vote in favor of this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that, you know, Representative Newman, how did Ms. Doherty get to where she was such that she had to walk home in the snow?
Representative Newman.
Representative Ellison, earlier in the evening she had driven to a bar in downtown St. Cloud, as I understand it, and after leaving the bar, got in her vehicle and began driving home and got stuck in a snowstorm.
Further discussion? All right, on the amendment, A11. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. All right, moving on. A20, Representative Newman, sex offenders from other states or tribal heritage. A20.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, members, this is an amendment. I'm going to make a real quick statement, and then I'm going to withdraw the amendment. The genesis of this amendment initially came by way of Representative Lanning, who was concerned about predatory offenders coming in from a foreign jurisdiction, in other words, other states. I took that amendment and I added to it the language concerning folks who come from sovereign nations, otherwise tribal reservations, be it within the state of Minnesota or without the state of Minnesota. I've had further conversations concerning this amendment, and I am satisfied that it needs further work before we go any further. I simply want to raise your awareness at this point that there is a problem concerning predatory offenders coming into the state of Minnesota from either another state or off of a reservation, and I can't say for certain whether I will be back with an amendment on the floor in this matter or not. If I am not, I would ask that you be aware of it and look for it next year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman, thank you. A41, Mr. King, are you here? Go ahead and have a seat. Chair will move the A41 amendment. Mr. King or someone, please, since I think this comes from your neck of the woods, do you want to tell us what this is about?
Mr. Chair, I'm Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor for the Secretary of State. And with me today is Benita Harview, who is a program analyst in our office, and she's going to tell you about the fraudulent filing rejection of the act.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, as Bert said, I'm Benita Harview, a business analyst for the Office of the Secretary of State. The bill before you establishes a process for an expedited judicial review of the UCC financing statement in cases where it's believed that a statement or other record is fraudulently or improperly filed. A UCC financing statement under the Uniform Commercial Code is recorded to pledge a security interest for collateral so other lenders know that that collateral is already taken. Everybody is potentially a victim of such a filing. As a filing officer for the Secretary of State for over 8 years, I can attest to the fact that many public officials are victims, such as judges, elected officials, court staff, county clerks, law enforcement officials, as well as the general public. In fact, I have a $64 million financing statement that was filed against members of the administration, the Senate, and the House in the state of Minnesota, and the U.S. Attorney.
Unfortunately, nobody on this committee.
Thank you. Fortunately, not none of these committee members were on this filing. In order to address the problem, a national task force was established and modeled language from the states of Texas and Kansas. The Minnesota Task Force, which I co-chaired, used that language to draft this bill, and those that were involved in it were the county recorders, county attorneys, attorney general's office, district court officials, law enforcement officials, Minnesota Bar Association, and the Minnesota Bankers Association. Those involved in this process believe this is a crime as it is used by the offender as a means of harassment. The offender is retaliating against unsuspecting individuals for behavior that they do not like by filing these bogus liens and identifying the victim as the debtor. Most victims do not realize there is such a filing against them until they go to obtain a loan, purchase a home, or refinance. Thank you for your time.
And Mr. Chairman and members, let me just indicate this is Representative Vanderveer's bill. Was heard and passed by the Commerce Committee and the Civil Law Committee. That section from section 11 to the end, the first 10 sections of the bill relate to permitting notaries, which are now within the purview of the Office of the Secretary of State, to perform their notarial acts by electronic means. We already have in Minnesota Chapter 325L, which is the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, and that act permits the concept of notarization electronically, but it doesn't provide for the means of doing that, and that's really what these amendments here do. I do want to point out one item to assure everybody. If you look at page 6, lines 3, 4, and 5, I want to pinpoint that. Please note that that says a notarial officer may not know. Please note that that says a notarial officer may not notarize the physical or electronic signature of any signer who is not in the presence of the notary at the time of notarization. And that's important to make sure that there isn't anything like identity theft going on. So you have to physically be there in order for the notary to electronically notarize. But that's still useful because we have many electronic documents that must be, there is no hard copy, and so the notary must place their notarization on electronically. And so that is the reason for those portions of this amendment. And I thank you for your time.
Is it Black?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Black, we're going to pass out photocopies for the members of a UCC financing statement, and what appears to be, and would you give him a copy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, David. While it's being passed out, let me just move this discussion along so we can get on to some other work as well. About two pages in, or what would be the fourth page, there's a UCC financing statement photocopy indicating the name of the filer. For the record, David J., last name beginning with a J, listing his residence as Moose Lake. That'd be our correctional facility at Moose Lake. And the first two pages show a list of people he has filed UCC filings against. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the UCC system is all public information, so these are, and of course I think you all recognize the names on the first page, and you'll recognize some of the names on the other pages too. I would suspect that this inmate...
he's got the governor, he's got the attorney general, he's got judges, he's got various commissioners, and a bunch of folks. The guy's been busy. He seems to have a lot of time on his hands at Moose Lake.
Productive day.
Apparently.
Mr. Black, is there a cost connected with charged in connection with filing a UCC filing at the Secretary of State's office?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There's a flat fee. It's been in place since 2001. I believe that's $20 to file a Uniform Commercial Code statement. But I can tell you that the cost of the $20 certainly doesn't cover the cost of the expungements which are going on right now. Frankly, what happens is...
Well, wait a minute, Mr. Black.
Yes.
I want to hear that testimony, but it's a little further than I wanted to get right now.
Okay.
$20 to file one. Were these filings by this person at Moose Lake Correctional Facility, were they done by electronic filing, or were they done by hard copy sent in the mail to the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Chairman, I'm advised by Ms. Harview, who ran that program for a number of years, that this was a paper filing.
What did he did? Well, then, did this person send $20 in with every filing that he made?
Well, I will tell you that it's a flat fee for an unlimited number of debtors. So it would just be one $20 fee, but he would have had to pay the $20. Yes.
So then what I'm looking at, he filed one UCC filing against all these people at the same time?
That is correct.
All right.
And by the way, I might add, this really is the $64 million question, because if you look on the, I think, the third to last page, you'll see the amount of the lien is $64 million, $155,000. I guess he threw that in there for good measure. This is a real problem. It's a nationwide problem.
Mr. Black, is there a current process in place for getting rid of, I think you may have been started down that road, for getting rid of these off of one's record, these filings, and what is that process? What does it take to get your name off of this guy's list?
And Mr. Chairman and members, the process is actually one where you have to go you have to file a regular cause of action in district court and for expungement of the particular filing. And frankly, the expungement is particular to the filing and particular to the filer. So let me give you an example. The court administrators in, I believe it's Dakota County, every one of them, of the folks who work there, have had one of these filed on them. We have gotten, I don't want to say numerous, several expungement orders over a period of time, a couple of years, expunging these kinds of filings. The amendment, would allow for an expedited judicial review of those filings, and if it were egregious enough on its face, the judicial officer hearing this, whether it's a judge or referee or some other judicial officer, could order the Secretary of State's office to expunge them. We do not have the authority to expunge it, and in fact, we're not fact finders. So we aren't really in a position to determine that. That is a judicial process. But we want the idea behind this, both nationally and in Minnesota, is to make sure that victims of these filings can get some relief without having to go to court, with going through that whole process, backing up court calendars, and essentially just really paying an additional price for being in public office. And by the way, I might add, it's not only public officials who are the victims of this. This is really a harassment issue, because if your neighbor doesn't like you, they could do it to you.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions of Mr. Black? If not, we're going to take action on this amendment, A41 amendment. Discussion? Any discussion? If not, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. It's adopted. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members.
A49 amendment. Judge Gomez, are you here? Hello. Welcome, Judge Gomez. Have a seat and tell us about the A49 amendment.
I am Isabel Gomez, the Executive Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and 849 is has two parts, but the part that is a little more difficult to understand is essentially a technical amendment of a printing error in the report to the legislature this year. The report to the legislature encompasses a proposal for a new grid and a new process for sentencing sex offenders. As part of that grid, the Sentencing Commission ranked all sex offenses. When the report was printed, there are six charts in the report indicating rankings of various offenses. Three of the charts are correct and do, in fact, set out what the Commission's decision was as well as what was approved after public hearing. Three of the charts, I was informed on my first day in this office, were in fact printed incorrectly. And the net result is that if, as we hope representatives you will do, you decide not to oppose the sex offender proposal and it goes into effect on August 1, there will be confusion because there are three lists that are correct and three lists that are incorrect. And anyone sentencing a psychotherapist who commits a sexual misconduct, a religious counselor, priest, minister who commits sexual misconduct, or a teenager who, being no more than 3 years older than a victim who is 13 years old or younger, anyone sentencing those people will be confused as to how the offenses should be ranked. So what we have is a typographical error, and that's what this language set forth on 849 is about. It directs the commission to rank the violations. The violations are requested to be ranked exactly as the commission has already ranked them, but the idea is simply to eliminate clearly the incorrect language that was printed in the report to the legislature. It's what we call in the law a Scribner's error, but needless to say, both I and the commission would have preferred that it not have been made, but it was. And so if anyone has any questions about that, I'd be glad to answer them. There is no bet impact.
Any questions from the committee of Judge Gomez on this issue? Yes, Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the guideline will still go into effect as planned, or this is putting it off? Or
no. There would be. It is up to the legislature whether the guidelines go into effect. If the report, if the sex offender proposal contained in the report to the legislature is not voted down by the legislature, it will go into effect on August 1. If that happens without this amendment, then practitioners will be confused because they've got three charts that say one thing about those offenses that I indicated, Representative Hillstrom, and three other charts that say something else about those offenses. The erroneous charts rank the offenses lower, a step lower, than the correct ones. And since they're very rarely prosecuted offenses altogether, in terms of bet impact, it doesn't matter one way or another. So if you did not approve this amendment, but the legislature did did allow the sex offender proposal to go forward, the net result would be confusion as to these three offenses.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is maybe a question to Mr. Carger. Did we actually fund the bet impact of the report that is supposed to go into effect August 1st in our bill?
I apologize. I was distracted. Please repeat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is probably to Mr. Carger. The question is, did we fund the new chart that will go into effect August 1st?
Mr. Carger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, we did not.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, do you anticipate that we'll be doing something different, either with accepting the guidelines or just telling the department they have to eat it? Or I'm curious as to about the your plan for the finances.
Judge Gomez, can you help us out? Did the Senate fund this? Is it in their bill, and did they fund it? I believe the answer is
not. What happened was that the Senate, which is funding the DLC budget at a higher level than the House is at present, did not change the net amount of funding to DLC given this first year bed impact. What we have is a bed impact for year one that is hard to judge, but not catastrophic, my understanding is, from DLC. The whole proposal, I should go back. It is pretty unusual for the Guidelines Commission to come to the legislature with a proposal, the sex offender sentencing proposal, which increases demands additional prison resources. And it is important to understand that the commission, and indeed everybody who testified in front of the commission, agreed that this new sex offender grid was a good idea and worth the cost. First of all, the bed impact is substantially less than the bed impact of the life sentences with parole board that the legislature passed last year. This proposal of ours extends and continues the work of this body and policymakers on sex offender sentencing. It was the judgment of the commission that the old base grid was inappropriate for sentencing sex offenders for a number of reasons. First of all, at the top end, the sentences were too low. Most important, it did not recognize the importance of recidivism in sex offenders. Sex offenders are different from other offenders in this important way. Their very large majority of sex offenders never commit more than one offense. When we have a sex offender who does commit a second time, right along the continuum of harm, whether you're talking at the bottom end or the high end, we have got a problem and we know it. The old grid does not react to that problem. This new grid does, because it ranks a prior sex offense, it grants more points in criminal history, it moves faster to the maximum. A second offense will in every case result in being halfway to the maximum without additional criminal history points. And we think that public safety requires that. It is our hope that within the next year or two, our discussion of handling sex offenders, as well as our discussion of resources and how they ought to be allocated, will allow the commission to weigh in on some proposals that will reduce impact. One thing that I would just point out to you, if we punish serious sex offenders adequately in the front end, because of the steps that you took last year, because of these steps, we reduce the necessity for this commitment process. If we commit one fewer person, we are freeing up five beds, because it costs about five times as much to commit somebody every year to pay for that commitment as to pay for one bed. And furthermore, we would be punishing people for what they've already done, as opposed to keeping people out of circulation because of what they might do in the future, which is much more in keeping with our traditional ideas of sentencing. I would simply say we're aware that the bed impact is high. We're doing it on purpose. It's not easy for the commission to do. You haven't had many occasions, those of you who've been here a while, representative, where someone from the commission has come in and said, we're causing an increase in the need for beds. We're doing it on purpose, and we're doing it because we think public safety requires it. What we're doing. And I would also point out that we're concerned to keep proportionality and to keep truth in sentencing and to keep disparities, unnecessary disparities from occurring. All of those things happen if we have a guideline system that adequately encompasses these offenses. It doesn't happen if we start taking offenses out of the guidelines and making them indeterminate with the parole board. And so I would simply say this proposal, expensive as it is a whole lot less expensive than pretty much every other proposal that was out last year. I will also say, as I already did, that we have had the approval of judges, prosecutors, no arguments from the defense, and so on. So we do believe it's rational.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that we need to do the sentencing guideline. My question really was about whether or not we're going to fund it. Because the last thing that I would like to have people say about this committee is that we, you know, put programs into place and then we don't pay for them.
Is there anyone from the DOC that can come down and address the cost of funding?
Mr. Chair?
Address the absorption of the cost of funding. Mr. Carter?
I think while they're coming down, I might have the answer to that. I think, if I remember right, it's 39 beds in fiscal year 07, and the cost, there was a fiscal note done on the Senate bill, and it was somewhere around $547,000, I believe. The 08 and 09 cost should be picked up in the forecast. There's a forecast, corrections has a forecast, so that the 08 and 09 should be taken care of there. But maybe Mr. King or Mr. Benson can give some further clarification on that.
John, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jim King from the Department of Finance. To clarify the fiscal impact, the fiscal note that's been done in this language has 39 beds in fiscal year 7, and the cost is $547,000. And in fiscal year 8, it's 95 beds, $1,681,000. In fiscal year 9, 145 beds, $2,908,000. And I think to go back to Representative Pilsen's question earlier, my understanding of what the Senate did on this is they included language similar to what you're looking at here. They did not provide additional funding in fiscal year 7 for this, but they did show the additional costs in the so-called tails in fiscal years 8 and 9.
One final question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me if this was part of the governor's proposal to fund this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, no, it was not.
Representative Murphy, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The governor's proposal, the line on his budget says DOC and guidelines, sentencing guidelines, and sex offender proposal. But he didn't change the bottom line. So.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there was no item in the governor's budget relating specifically to the sentencing guidelines on proposal.
I'm done.
Representative Hillstrom?
I'm done. Thanks.
Okay. On the amendment, 849, any additional questions at this time? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Chairman and Representative.
On the 849, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. I will do that. Representative Johnson, do you want to offer an amendment at this time?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I think it's being passed out right now.
I will move the 851 amendment, Mr. Chairman, and then I have an oral amendment to that.
Okay, go ahead.
My oral amendment would be to delete lines 4.21 through 4.32. Which is one of the three pieces of the amendment.
Okay, on your oral amendment, on that deletion, let's deal with...
And Mr. Chairman, that's just a piece of the bill that is still very controversial, and it's not worth fighting over today.
Well, let's wait till this is passed around. Was it Representative Johnson? Was that the only deletion?
Yes.
Do you want to handle that as the A51 as? You can incorporate that amendment on your own.
That's fine.
All right, let's deal with the amendment then.
Could we just please repeat the amendment now that we have the amendment?
Go ahead.
Delete lines 4.21 through lines 4.32. And Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask Ms. Long to just briefly describe the two sections that remain in the bill, and then Mr. Jacobson may have a comment as well.
Identify yourself and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, my name is Karen Long. I'm the staff attorney at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I am a former prosecutor and now working in training and resources for criminal justice professionals regarding the issue of sexual assault. And I wonder, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, if we could just have a clarification of the deletion, because we're a little confused about the lines that were deleted.
Representative Johnson.
What I had moved was 4.21 through 4.32, because I believe that was the second section, but I may. Do I have the lines wrong?
According to what I understood, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that's the first section of our second piece.
Okay. Why don't you, if you would, explain the two pieces that we're keeping, and we'll figure out what we need to take out. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I will take back my incorporated amendment, if I could.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The first piece in the amendment is basically just conforming the confidentiality provision for sexual assault advocates who are trained under a 40-hour training requirement to similar language for that of clergy and psychologists. It just simply makes the language match that of other sections of the same statute. And then the second part, which I believe where there may have been a slight error in the lines that were deleted, starts out as a definition of personal body services. And this is a section that was discussed and brought to us by prosecutors who were dealing with, in their particular cases, massage therapists who were using the opportunity and using their profession to touch or penetrate non-consensually in a sexual manner. And because there was no force used, because, of course, the victim had agreed to disrobe and agreed to some touching for purposes of the professional treatment, because there's no force used, because there's no weapon or multiple assailants, there was no felony element present. So what prosecutors had available to them was gross misdemeanor, fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct. So I think we want to emphasize, first of all, that the conduct that we're talking about in this amendment is currently unlawful and illegal, but it's only unlawful at the level of a gross misdemeanor. And prosecutors felt that, first of all, these people would not be required to register as a sex offender. The behavior would not be enhanced, so multiple convictions under that section would continue to be gross misdemeanors. And they felt that because a person who goes to a massage therapist or potentially a tattoo artist or a piercing or some other bodily service where you have bodily contact that's permitted by the client for hire, that in those situations, because the person is then vulnerable to the abuse of that situation by the professional, the prosecutors asked us to develop language with them that would create third and fourth degree crim sex under those circumstances. And so that's what this language is. It would then also require those individuals to register as a sex offender and be monitored as a sex offender. We had a case out of Olmsted County, for example, where one massage therapist was charged with, I believe, non-consensual contact in a sexual manner. While he was pending that charge, he then committed more offenses, including penetration, non-consensually, and for all of those offenses was charged with gross misdemeanor only, because it wasn't a felony-level contact. So I can note that the County Attorney's Association is not in favor of that particular language simply because they felt that the language was too broad as it pertains to the professions that are mentioned. So I want to note that.
My name is Glenn Jacobson. I'm an assistant Arundel County attorney. I'm one of the dozen or so prosecutors and professionals that were involved for the past about a year or so in trying to put together this language. There have been a great number of people putting a great number of time and hours into drafting this and presenting it to you today.
Any questions? Representative Pilstrom, then Ellison. Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a fiscal note on this bill?
Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, I think we just received this amendment today, so we have not had a chance to request one.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any idea of how many crimes may be that previously were charged as gross misdemeanors that now may likely be felony?
Can someone help us?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not believe that the numbers would be substantial. All of the proposals specifically directed at personal body and cosmetic services was the genesis was out of a small number of cases. As we have discussed this within our group and on the listserv over the past year, there have been very few, if any, additional cases that have been brought. I do not foresee that this would have a significant impact. But because the people that partake in these professions are not subject to a great deal of licensing or supervision, they are able to freely move about the area. So at the current time, there is no tracking. There's no registration. It is very uncommon, if not impossible for someone to check a BCA criminal history record before going in and getting a tattoo.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, isn't non-consensual sexual penetration illegal now?
It is illegal now. It is a gross misdemeanor. Lacking elements such as force, incapacitation on the part of the victim, physical helplessness, lacking any other element other than non-consensual sexual penetration, it is a gross misdemeanor, non-registrable offense.
Mr. Chair, so if a person up to you without your consent and performs sexual penetration upon your person, that's not first degree criminal sexual conduct?
Mr. Chair, if they can do so, Representative, without the use of force or coercion, technically, no.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess if you're not consenting to it, and they're doing it, there must be an element of force there, or because you're not agreeing to it.
Ms. Long. Sure,
Mr. Chair, I think the purpose that we're trying to serve here, Representative Ellison, is under the circumstance where a person is laying on a table or sitting in a chair, they have potentially disrobed to some degree, their eyes are potentially closed, they're listening to the music, and unawares, the next thing that happens is that a penetration of an intimate part occurs. Under that circumstance, it wouldn't take force and hasn't. And prosecutors came to us and said, we don't have the element of force that would normally make this a third-degree crim sex. A date rape, if you will, or those situations are normally a forced situation, which means that, third-degree felony criminal sexual conduct is the charge. But in these situations where a person is, their guard is down, they are vulnerable to whatever touching the professional chooses to do, what we're saying is that's taking advantage of a situation that ought to become a felony level.
Mr. Chair, what if someone was laying in the park at Lake Calhoun on a blanket, nice hot summer day, getting a tan, and somebody walked up to them unawares and engaged in non-consensual sexual penetration when they had their eyes closed? That's a felony, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, I will also defer, I know there's some other prosecutors in the room. I think truly under those exact circumstances, a prosecutor would be hard-pressed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the element of force. And I think they would be looking at a gross misdemeanor fifth-degree charge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, a typical lawyer's answer, it depends. And there are always going to be more factors than perhaps you've just elucidated. However, given that that minimum number of factors to deal with, you know, that's what you're looking at.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Locke.
And Representative Ellison, I mean, I think what you're looking at is the element of non-consent, and your eyebrows are kind of raising because you're saying, that's not permissible, it's not consensual, and I totally agree with that. The element of non-consent is present in fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, which is a gross. It's the force element where you're threatening to inflict bodily harm, you're using confinement or superior size. That element is not present.
Mr. Chair, I had my, you know, I just had a law book here, and I don't know what happened to it, but in fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, as I understand it, and I could be wrong because, you know, I had it to the page, but we're not talking penetration. I mean, in this case, we are talking penetration. We're talking about, you know, invasion of an intimate body part of a person. And as I understood fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct, what we're talking about is sexual contact, not penetration. But when you delve into penetration, then you're in new ground. Then you're in a felony level situation. Am I wrong about that? Because I'm looking right at fifth degree criminal sexual contact and criminal sexual contact in the fifth degree, and it uses the word contact, not penetration. So am I wrong,
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Long.
Representative Ellison, I think you're right that fifth degree criminal sexual conduct refers to the word contact, and yes, other felony level offenses refer to the word penetration, but in order to get the entire list of elements for those that refer to the word penetration, the prosecutor's got to have the element of force, the wrong, you know, an unlawful age of the victim. There are other elements that must be met as well for penetration to become a felony level offense. If you're talking about penetration solely without those felony elements, you've got to squeeze it into the definition of fifth degree contact. Because without the additional elements that are listed in the many subdivisions under the term penetration, you don't have all the elements of the offense, and I'll guarantee that a good criminal defense attorney such as yourself would latch on to that.
Representative Ellison, can we go to Representative Meslin,
yeah, we
for just a second? Do you have something on this?
I do, Mr. Chair. Representative Ellison, I think I can answer your question. I've got the statute book in front of me, too. In the situation that you described with someone asleep on a beach towel, in order for that to be a felony, you'd need to look at section 609.344 subdivision 1D, and it would have to fit into the category where the actor knows or has reason to know the complainant is physically helpless. And I think that would be the additional element that would be required under the existing statute. That's Crimsex 3, but there's nothing that would be different under CRIMSEC 4. The only difference between 3 and 4 is contact versus penetration. And so my interpretation would be that if we don't adopt this and a situation happens where somebody's getting a massage and there is sexual penetration, it's going to be CRIMSEC 5 unless there's a determination that the person was physically helpless. And so what we're doing if we make this change is we no longer have to, a prosecutor would no longer have to establish that physically helpless qualification. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair, yeah, that actually is helpful. Let's just go there then. If a person is on a receiving a massage, is listening to the music and is laying there on the bed and your head is on the thing, and aren't you helpless then,
Mr. Chair?
Certainly not expecting to be penetrated.
Well, I agree with the second part of your statement. I believe if you look at the definition of physically helpless under 609.341, and I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it refers to things such as asleep, unconscious. And I know that case law has interpreted it to mean things like being physically disabled to the degree that one cannot move or withdraw from the contact that they don't agree with. I do not believe it refers to simply laying still or... And I'm sorry, I don't have the language in front of me, but my belief about physically helpless has always been that it refers to being quite physically incapacitated, such as being unable to move or asleep or unconscious.
Thank you.
And I guess I will just reiterate that, you know, as Mr. Jacobson said, we did work on this with a group of prosecutors representing various counties that are all prosecutors who focus on criminal sexual conduct as their practice.
Representative Newman and then Hailstrom. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if Mr. Cahill is still here or not, but I was wondering if he could come forward. I'd like to hear his comments on this bill, if he'd be willing to do so.
Mr. Cahill, identify yourself again, and then Representative Newman, do you want to ask a question to start his discourse, or do you want him to just open up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, essentially, I'd like to hear his views on this bill, and if you wouldn't mind, kind of zero in on this issue, the element of force, for me.
Cahill. Pete Cahill from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, once again appearing for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. The County Attorneys Association Board did take a position opposing this as being too broad. The concern is legitimate, and we'd like to work with the various parties involved to perhaps come up with some different language. But as written right now, and to be honest, I just looked at it, and we've just got the language. I think it's pretty much the same as we passed on at our board meeting. But our concern was that it was a little broad, doesn't directly and surgically address the issue we're talking about, but it's legitimate. There are prosecutors, experienced prosecutors, who are in favor of this, and so I don't think this is a unanimous position of all prosecutors in the state, but just so you're aware what the position is that our board took on this issue.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cahill, did you all take a position on this section that was deleted then put back in on line 4.21 down through line 4.32?
Mr. Chairman, if I could address that. I intend to keep that out. We were just confirming that we had the right lines.
Okay. Never mind.
Representative Hailstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very interested in how the, you know, prostitution statute might fit into this, if at all. Maybe it doesn't. But it is my understanding that, you know, again, paying for a sexual act is a crime, and performing a sexual act for money is a crime. And so, although this is not wanted, couldn't one argue that these people were almost doing some type of prostitution.
Mr. Chair, we, Representative Hillstrom, we did have that conversation in our group, that, because certainly we all know that massage therapy can mask a prostitution agreement. And so we had that conversation. We think the big distinction is that this applies only to non-consensual sexual conduct, whereas in that circumstance, if the prosecutor had facts in front of her that indicated that this was in fact a prostitution act masked by a massage therapy, that in fact it would not be non-consensual, it would be consensual, and that the prostitution statute is the one that would apply. So we did have that conversation. We actually discussed using the term non-consensual right in the statute, or that consent would be a defense, and we ended up deleting that as kind of redundant, but consent would be a defense to this, to this statute.
Any further questions on the 851 amendment? Oh. All right. No further discussion on the 851 amendment.
Oh, can I just confirm that I did want to remove that?
Johnson, I was just going to ask you to clarify what we're voting on.
I did want to remove lines 4.21 through line 4.32. And that piece was not discussed at all because we intended to take it out.
Okay, and that's the A51 amendment as the, moved by Representative Johnson, Representative Murphy.
One more question, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. Is this the only place that has had a policy hearing?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have the massage therapist organizations or the piercing, if there is one, you know, weighed in about this issue at all?
Well, since we're dealing with a new sex crime involving improper massage, that's a legitimate question. Do we have any massage parlor owners or representatives or lobbyists for massage parlor owners in the room for some testimony? Or whatever you call them. Nobody wants to admit to that, I see. All right.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Jacobson.
Ms. Hill, as we worked on this language, I did discuss it with the massage parlor in Olivia, who is a certified therapeutic massage member, and she was in agreement with the language. She felt that it was appropriate to take action against the members of her profession who were not conducting themselves in appropriate and professional manner.
Is that where this, is that where the incident occurred that's prompted this bill?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hillstrom.
The reason why I'm asking is because my brother-in-law happens to be a chiropractor, and I have on more than one occasion gone to a real massage therapist, and given the fact that they haven't weighed in, I just want to make certain that we're not criminalizing something that some people find as, you know, valuable. And while I think it's inappropriate to touch people in places they don't want to be touched, I think this, with the county attorney's office weighing in opposition to this bill because it's so broad, I certainly would like to hear from, you know, some of the other groups as well.
Mr. Chairman. I did introduce this as a bill, and no one came to talk to me about it.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Long.
And I would like to note, too, that we actually did, we affirmatively sought to locate an association of either massage therapists or piercing professionals or tattoo. We couldn't find any associations of that type in Minnesota. There are national associations. I mean, we did some work. I had a law clerk last summer who tried to find these people to talk to them, and we couldn't find any such associations. So there were no formal groups that we could meet with. We certainly would have wanted to work with them, but we just couldn't find any such places. So.
Any further questions? Then let's deal with the amendment. If there's no further questions,
on the 851 amendment. Those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Chair's in doubt. Those in favor, please raise your hand of the amendment. Those opposed, thank you, put them down. Those opposed to the amendment, raise your hand. 7-2 in my bank account did pass.
Yeah,
all right.
Very loud.
Members, we're getting down towards the end of the agenda. We have, as far as I can tell, left in our packets proposed amendments, the A31 and the A44. The A31 would amend the law enforcement inquiry provision in the bill. The A44 amendment would delete the bias crimes provision. And we have the A46 amendment dealing with address confidentiality provision, $50,000 amount, and the A33 amendment, $200,000 for reentry provision. We also have a motion we're going to want to deal with on Representative Cole. So that brings us to the A31 and the A44 amendment. And as chair of the committee, I would ask that before we get into either one, that since this bill is being presented as with those two elements, essentially the two anchors of this bill, or at least that's what I've labeled it as chair, that I would ask the committee vote down both of those amendments. Now we can present the amendments.
There's a good
sorry, but I just thought I'd be up front, Representative Paymar. That's what I'm thinking. Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, I'll appeal to the committee's judgment here and maybe and ask you to find a middle ground for what I think has been a problem with the Smith bill that essentially preempts the ordinances that Minneapolis and St. Paul adopted. And so this is sort of a middle ground that I would just ask you to consider that I think is fair. It's allowing Representative Smith to, and Representative Knobloch actually, to say that cities cannot enact ordinances, but it does give some leeway to police chiefs and sheriffs to enact their own policy relative to officers asking questions of relative to immigration status. And I think that, members, you all heard from the police chiefs, the associations, the sheriff's associations, the police associations, individual police chiefs, that they opposed the Knobloch bill, they opposed the Smith bill, and for lots of reasons, I don't think we need to rehash all those issues here, but this just, it allows you to keep the language in there on city ordinances, but does give police departments some latitude, and I would ask you to support the amendment.
And this is the A31 amendment, is that correct, Representative Paymar?
Yes.
And discussion on the A31. Further comment, Representative Paymar?
Did my best.
Very good, you did well. Let's see what happens. On the amendment, all those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no.
No.
Does not prevail. On the A44 amendment, it's going to be presented on that. Representative Eastman, do you want to do that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, there's some controversial things in the bill, and it's getting late, and I don't want to provoke hours of discussion either, but I guess I've had some misgivings about a couple of the provisions in the bill, and so I'd just like to offer an opportunity to vote on them. So I'm going to offer the A44 amendment, and I have an author's amendment to attach to it. And the author's amendment would be the A14 amendment. So basically what this amendment would do is it would delete the provisions in the bill relating to the bias crimes issue. And I guess my position on that is that it greatly, greatly expands our current law. We currently have some bias crimes provision in law, and they deal primarily with assault and property crimes. What this provision does in the bill is to basically reference all, whatever the statute, is it 609? All of the 609 statute regarding criminal behavior, and it's 200 pages of statutes that all of a sudden become the universe of what we could do to use to create bias crime. So, I mean, I think the bias crime portion is extremely broad and greatly expanding what we currently have in statute, and I think it deserves a lot more attention than a hearing on the last day of session of our before the deadline and then coming into the bill. So that's the reason that for the proposal to delete that portion, and then also the second portion that I'm proposing we delete is the section on the sanctuary laws that has been very controversial all along. We have already passed it on the House floor, and it had 90 plus or 90 some votes, I think we've made our statement and we have our political votes, and I think if we could cut the two anchors loose, we'd have a boat that might float.
Discussion, Representative Ellison.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I don't think that anybody who does not commit a crime with bias motivation doesn't have to worry about this amendment. If you obey the law and you don't commit basically hate crimes, you'll be fine. So I think that this bill is this amendment is not a good amendment, and I urge your members not to support it. And I wouldn't want the people of the state of Minnesota to get the impression that the state legislature doesn't want to be tough on hate crimes. So I'm definitely going to oppose it.
Further discussion on the Eastland Amendment. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, you talked about two different sections of the bill. I don't understand. Are we doing one amendment first and the other amendment second?
I guess what I did is I incorporated the A14 amendment into my A44 amendment, which we would have two. There would be two sections, one to delete the bias crimes, the other to delete the sanctuary ordinance.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to, I don't know how to do it. Mr. Depot, is there a way to divide the amendment?
Mr. Depot. Mr. Nebel, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, I think, first of all, we should probably specify what the A14 says, and then you could vote on the two provisions separately.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members, I would simply add to the A44 amendment on page 41, delete section 7, which is the sanctuary law provision.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to divide the amendment then to vote on the bias crimes set first. So, okay, the deletion of that section from the bill.
I understand what you want to achieve. Mr. Debo, for the record, tell us what we're about to vote on.
Mr. Chair and members, you would be voting on the A44 unamended.
What motion is currently on the table? I'll make one up if I have to. Motion to divide the amendments. So let's deal with that, and then we'll see if we're going to divide it or not, and then it would be a simple matter, however procedurally we get there. If you want to vote separately on the bias crime provision, we'll find a way to do that. In fact, why don't we just get to the point? Representative Eastland,
Do you want to vote on both of them together? Or do
I intentionally included them together and incorporated them together.
All right. Well, then we're going to have to deal with a motion to divide. There's a motion before us to divide. To separate the two issues. On that motion, discussion?
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Payman.
I don't understand. I'm not asking the committee. I'm asking to divide the amendment, not whether the committee wants to divide. I mean, he's amended. He's combined these two amendments, and I want to divide them. No, that's not what it's...
Representative Paymer, what I was trying to achieve was, since Representative Eastland has a motion on the table which combines the two issues, and I thought you had offered a motion to divide to determine the question of whether the committee will let that motion be divided.
No, that was not my intent. Our intent was to divide the Eastland amendment.
We're going to do that by committee vote, and then ask which part you want to vote on first.
I've never heard of that. Mr. Chair, then I'll restate my motion, which would be to divide the Eastland Amendment by voting on lines 1, 3, 1, 4, 1, 5, 1, 6 first, and then to vote, which is the deletion on page 17 and 25, and to vote on that first.
The motion is to divide for purposes of voting first on the portion you requested. So on the motion to divide, is there any question on our motion? Representative Newman.
Yeah, I have now become confused, and I apologize.
The motion before us is a motion to divide for purposes of voting on one portion first. If you vote yes, the motion will be divided, and then we will vote on the portion directly.
Mr. Gilday, can you? That's not what we just talked about.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymer, I believe the proper motion is, as the chairman stated it, and as I believe I understood you to state it, that you're moving to divide the amendment and vote on the first part first and the second part second, and that motion has to be approved by the committee before we can vote on the first part first and then on the second part second.
Further discussion on that amendment?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Ellis.
What does a yes vote mean?
Yes, if you want to divide it.
Yes to divide.
Yes.
And both pieces will still be there. And then we'll go to what do we want one of them.
If somebody follows it up with a second motion to bring one or the other to a vote.
Okay.
On the motion to divide only. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
Division.
Division has been called for. Those in favor of the motion to divide, raise your hand. Those opposed, thank you. Those opposed to the motion, raise your hand. Five to six, it fails. Does not pass.
So we return to the Eastland Amendment.
As amended.
We'll discuss that. Still on the table before us.
The amendment would delete both the bias claims and the sanctuary.
On the Eastland motion, which will have the effect to delete both the bias crime provisions and the sanctuary provision, the motion is before us for further discussion. Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no.
No.
Does not pass.
Okay. Representative Eastland,
A-46.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A-46 amendment is the amendment or the bill that we heard as a courtesy to the Secretary of State. It has to do with the address confidentiality program that the Secretary would run for someone who is has reason to maintain some confidentiality for fear of harassment of some sort. So she presented the bill very well. That's what this bill is, or that's what this amendment is, and we've slated $50,000 in the bill to fund the beginning of this program.
Any questions on the 846 amendment? Discussion? Those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. 846 is adopted. 833, Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my amendment increases the amount of money that we be giving to the offender reentry program, increasing it to $300,000, adding $200,000 more. And this funding would be given to some group that would implement a comprehensive statewide model for transitioning offenders into the community. And I guess I'll just leave it at that. I would like to point out that many other states are spending money and starting to look at spending a lot more money for offender reentry, and we are spending a lot of money on prisons, and I would encourage you to vote to increase this amount. Thank you.
Any questions or further any discussion on Representative Soderstrom's amendment? Mm-hmm. Representative Ellison and then Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to say, you know, we got about between 97 and 95% of all the people who are in Minnesota prisons, they are coming home. And when they come home, we want them better than we want them better coming out than when they went in. And unfortunately, we can't say that now. So I do hope you support this reentry initiative. And I want to commend Representative Soderstrom for doing this. I know it's she's doing good work, and I want to support her, and I hope all y'all do.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too support the provision. My question is, where does the money come from?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom. I took it from the DPS Immigration Special Crimes, that part of our budget.
Same thing that funded some of the other amendments.
Yes.
just pointing that out. All right, on the A-33 amendment, further discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. A-33 is amended. We have one other item, and that's on H. Sorry. You're right. Sorry. DE-1 as amended. The motion then is before us. The DE-1 amendment as amended. It would be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
As House File 2953,
excuse me. Discussion on that motion. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, can we get a... Before this is scheduled to go to taxes, So we have a gross copy, so that if we wanted to have, you said you were hoping to avoid a new meeting. But if there was something, we have so many amendments. If we have some time to review the gross copy before you go to have to, just in case then something.
You said confidence in the information that we're already...
Or is it already handled?
Representative Murphy, I'm getting advice trying to...
I know, for both ears.
Okay, and let me ask the staff a question first. Mr. Carter, can you help me answer this question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, before it goes to taxes, too, they will probably want the revenue estimate on the fire surcharge to determine the amount that that will bring in. And that still is outstanding.
Outstanding.
Did that help?
So what Ms. Carter is saying is that indeed we will have the engrossed copy in enough time so that if we found something that we wanted to reconsider, there would be time to call me.
Well, and Representative Murphy, the bill from here goes to taxes.
Perhaps. Or it might come back here.
At the point, well, I guess, let me try this out without engendering any yelling or screaming or too many further additional questions, I hope. The best I'm thinking of on the fly here is that when the bill is put together with all these amendments, and if you've read it and you have concerns or legitimate concerns, I could, as chairman, I suppose, request a re-referral to this committee and then put the whole bill in danger of being obviously delayed further.
Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to put obstacles up, but I just don't feel comfortable with some of these amendments, not really understanding some of these amendments, and just before releasing the bill. It's a major, major bill, and there's some things that, because of the amendments, we had kind of turnarounds on, and...
Well,
I just would like to read it once before we send it on to be changed again.
Representative Murphy, I think this is going to have to be the answer. Number one, our deadline is tonight. We don't have the choice to hang on to this bill, or we could kill it. We have to get it out of here. It has to move to taxes. This bill will go to Ways and Means. We have Representative Tamar and Representative Smith on Ways and Means. I would suggest that's going to have to suffice so that if there are concerns going beyond the wording or placement of commas, that Representative Tamar and Smith will have to bring it up and or deal with it at Ways and Means. I think to try to put a hook into this bill and or keep it or try to seek re-referral after this has been in growth, we're going to have to forego doing that and just let the two gentlemen I referred to take your concerns to Ways and Means, if there are any concerns. And off the record, if we had started in January 1st, we might not have run up against the wall in time.
That's an idea.
I agree, Representative Murphy. Okay, Representative Murphy and Tamar and everyone else. Mr. Carker, can you help us out with the issue of $16,000?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the total line is that we are under target by $16,000. This is due to a fiscal note that we received just recently on the revenue that comes into the state from Representative Ellison's bill on the Hennepin County fine redistribution. So I think one of the ideas that the chair and I think perhaps Representative Murphy floated was that of that $16,000, $5,000 would go to the Ramsey County pilot program and the other $11,000 would go to the BCA for their background checks.
Okay. Everyone understand?
For the mentoring program, that's statewide.
Right, for the mentoring program.
See, I was thinking of you guys a little earlier in the day. All right. Let's have a motion to allocate that money.
So moved.
Representative Paymar so moves. As stated, any discussion on that motion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. That would help. Let's do a motion to authorize staff to make any changes consistent with our action tonight so that we can proceed. Representative Meslow?
I do so move, Your Honor.
Okay. Any discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye on that. Thank you.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. We return now to the D. Excuse me. House File 2953, which contains our work product tonight. That is before the committee. This is a markup session. We are not going to take testimony tonight. Before the committee. Discussion. Hearing no discussion on the bill. House File 2953, as amended, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. I want to thank the committee tonight, but don't leave just yet. House File 2843, Representative Coles, is he here?
I'm the one between you and dinner, Mr. Chairman.
And members.
You came out of the woodwork, sir. I didn't see you still here. Tell us what we're doing. This is I believe we're moving Article 8, et cetera, into your bill so we can move you along. Please specify your request so the committee understands.
I will be very succinct and very direct. Earlier this morning, and thanks for having me back, earlier this morning, Article 8 was taken out of the omnibus bill, which contained the identity theft provisions. What my request of the committee is that House File 2843, which is in this committee's possession, we had a hearing last Tuesday on the bill. We had to wait for a fiscal note. There's one section of the bill that has fiscal implications. It is Section 16 dealing with skimming card fraud. My request would be that the committee delete that section of House File 2843 and move House File 2843 to rules so that we can continue to move forward this session with the identity theft provisions. Here in the House, as I mentioned earlier this morning, the bill passed out of the Senate yesterday, and we're trying to move forward to some identity theft legislation that can get passed this year. That's the request, Mr. Chair and members.
Does someone not understand the request or want to restate it by staff? Mr. Harris, help us out.
Mr. Chair and members, the member moves to amend House File 2843, the second engrossment, as follows. Page 11, delete Section 16, which would be the skimming fraud provision.
Mr. Chair, if you or one of the members on the committee would move that, that would be forever in your debt.
Representative Nelson so moves. Anything further, Ms. Pierce? Is that it? Representative Nelson's motion is before us. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, though. Representative Nelson.
I just earlier when he presented this bill, I had some questions, and we were asked at the time to put them aside when the bill came up. I've discussed them with Representative Cole since then, and he's working on those things, and I'm just satisfied with the answers he's giving me, so I just wanted to put that on the record.
Representative Nelson, thank you for doing that. Any further discussion? If not, on that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. We have no further items on our agenda. committee.
Mr. Chairman, does the bill need to be officially moved and sent to rules? I think what was just voted on was the amendment to delete that provision of House File 2843.
Okay.
I just want to make sure the bill gets technically moved to rules.
Without objection, the record will reflect that's the proper motion. And it's so moved. All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. That motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Enjoy your dinner.
You can leave now.
Did I hear you fine dinner?
What? I want to thank everyone as chair and also personally for your assistance in the last couple of years, as well as the last, golly, 6 weeks, 7 weeks. Again, it should have been a couple months, Representative Murphy, but that was enough to us. I have nothing further other than to thank you and wish you well, and I hope that the work that we've done stays intact all the way to a governor's signature later in the spring.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Meeting is adjourned.